Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, the final season of Game of Thrones has nothing on the Mueller saga. From William Barr's preamble this morning to the lightly redacted report, which is being delivered right now to Capitol Hill, an investigation that was 2 years in the making is having a finale of sorts today. This morning, Trump tweeted, "No obstruction, no collusion." Now the rest of us get to see if he's right. We kick off the show taking your calls on all things Mueller.
Then just in time for 2020 campaign fever and the season of grinning and grasping, a new study finds we've been using hand sanitizer all wrong. Now there's a 15-second rule. Our medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins for that and the latest attacks on Roe v. Wade. At noon, we continue the Mueller Report conversation with Andrew Cabral. Congressman Jim McGovern calls in with his take on the redacted report. And Alex Beam joins us for his famous explainer. That is next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. He's Tim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning.
Well, this is going to be one hell of a day, I'll tell you. I am Jim Browdy. You said that, you know, last month when William Barr released his four-page summary of the Mueller investigation, here's the key takeaway, not in Mueller's words, but in the words of the President of the United States.
There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction, and none whatsoever. And it was a complete and total exoneration. This was an illegal takedown that failed. And hopefully somebody's going to be looking at the other side. So it's complete exoneration, no collusion, no obstruction. Thank you very much.
So at this very moment, as you know, the lightly redacted Mueller report is being delivered to Capitol Hill and eminently to the American people. Will the president's self-declared exoneration still hold? Our number is 877-301-8970. We're taking your calls on Attorney General Barr's press conference, which hopefully you heard on the station at about 9:35 this morning, on the imminent release. I think it actually has been released to the public.
I think so, too, yeah.
Report on the DOJ website. Obviously, we have not yet read it. What are you expecting to find? What are you hoping to find? Here's some of the main points, if you didn't hear Barr's press conference, that Mueller examined 10 episodes, I think he called it, involving President Donald Trump when trying to determine whether Trump obstructed justice. Obviously, he didn't make that determination, but the Attorney General and Rod Rosenstein did. That, according to the Attorney General, Trump did not collude or conspire with the Russians. In fact, the Attorney General made that point at least six or seven times, which led some people to say it was almost like it was a Trump press conference. Barr also claimed the White House fully cooperated with Mueller, when, in fact, that was the most incredible for me. Trump refused to be interviewed by Mueller. The number is 877-301-8970. Here's the main, if we can just play the main conclusion of the Mueller investigation, at least according to William Barr this morning.
The special counsel did not find any conspiracy to violate U.S. law involving Russian-linked persons and any persons associated with the Trump campaign. So that's the bottom line. After nearly 2 years of investigation, thousands of subpoenas, hundreds of warrants and witness interviews, the special counsel confirmed that the Russian government sponsored efforts to illegally interfere with the 2016 presidential election, but did not find that the Trump campaign or other Americans colluded in those efforts.
Yeah, by the way, it will probably not be mentioned much, but the one place where they went different ways, Attorney General Barr, I was going to say, and his client, and the President of the United States, was Barr reaffirmed what all those intelligence agencies said. There was Russian interference in the election, and obviously the president, at best, is equivocal on that. And remember, he exonerated, essentially, speaking of exoneration, Putin at that joint press conference.
Well, I think that what was particularly noteworthy, and I suppose given that the Attorney General has acted in a way that does seem to, I think, even people that are fans of the president in a very partisan way, He never mentioned that the reason that the Russians were interfering with the election was to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton.
No, he did not say. That's a very good
and
point.
And so he never, with all the talk about that. But anyway, the 10 episodes of possible obstruction we'll be looking for in this report, one of them, of course, was, you presume, was when the president sat down with Lester Holt and said that he fired James Comey, the former head of the FBI, because of the Russia investigation. Then there was also the effort by Mr. Trump to have his counsel, his own White House counsel at the time, Don McGahn, fire Robert Mueller because of the investigation. So we'll see. I mean, this could turn out to be a everything we already know in terms of Mr. Trump calling the investigation a witch hunt and a hoax and an illegal takedown, as he just called it in that sound clip we just said, or whether there's more things that we don't know, or whether it's so redacted that it ends up being nothing new.
You know, I'm sure you've already heard that one of the key Democratic committee chairs says he wants Mueller to testify before his committee by May 23rd. The attorney general was asked that question. We have any objection to Mueller testifying? He said he did not. While he did show the redacted report to the White House counsel and Donald Trump's personal counsel, we can get into that, how odd that is, in a couple of seconds. The president's lawyers did not seek any redactions or changes. I think that's good. The president himself, through his counsel, did not claim executive privilege. I think that is good as well. So we'll try to figure out, as the day goes ahead, what lightly redacted means. 877-301-8970. I have to say, the thing that troubled me most was the gratuitous repetition of no conspiracy, no collusion. You could have said, after you listed the litany of findings by Mueller, you could have said, and in none of those findings did Mueller establish any collusion or conspiracy. He said it repeatedly. And by the way, we're going to play just 10 seconds of this. These are not replaying the exact same words. This is a series of statements by William Barr in rapid fashion during his, 20-minute press conference this morning.
The special counsel found no collusion, no underlying collusion with Russia, did not find that the Trump campaign or other Americans colluded in those efforts. There was, in fact, no collusion.
And it did. If you are an objective viewer, and I hope most of you are, and again, whether you're a Trump supporter or a Trump critic, it did come off as a really partisan event this morning.
Well,
the
very fact of the way he did this was very odd.
Is
many of the people that are prosecutors and federal prosecutors have already said this morning that if he was just going to come out and talk about the process, you know, that the legal process they went through in their examination of this, but it was a setup, a way to spin the report before it even comes out. And it may turn out that everything the attorney general said is absolutely correct. There's nothing new. There's nothing suspicious, even in 10 episodes of possible instruction. Or it may turn out that he's just what he is doing the second time, what he did the first time, which is give a very brief summary, 73 words, whatever it was, and decide in that summary that there was no reason to pursue the obstruction of justice in a criminal fashion, which Mueller said he wasn't going to make a decision on. So
you mean, when you say 73 words or whatever it was, you mean the actual words of Mueller in the four-page summary letter, right?
I think so.
Yeah, it was something like that.
Actually, I don't know how many words were in the whole thing. How many words were in the whole thing?
Well, obviously, it was four pages. It's much more than 73
words. 73 words of Mueller.
I'm looking through my totally illegible handwriting because I did not take cursive. Mm-hmm. He says that the White House took no act that deprived the special counsel of witnesses and documents.
How can he say this when
the key witness, the President of the United States, refused to testify? You know, one of the interesting things I'm curious to ask Michael Zeldin, who, as you know, is a special assistant to Bob Mueller, and he will be joining us at 12:30. If the issue, from what we understand so far, again, not having read the report, which was just released minutes ago, that intent was the critical issue that they couldn't establish on the obstruction issue, according to Mueller, theoretically, wouldn't that been enough reason for Mueller to demand an interview with Donald Trump?
Yes.
And as we learned, assuming it's true, during the first release, the late March release of that letter, and what Barr said before Congress, that Mueller never made a request that was refused. So by definition, He never requested the president to testify.
Well, what Zeldin said is he didn't he surmised that Mueller did not want to go that route of forcing the president to testify, thereby dragging this out for who knows how many months while they fought about it in court. And so that was why he just gave up on that. You know, we haven't heard from Mueller himself, and obviously we haven't seen the report. I have no idea if he even goes into that in the report. But I don't know if that makes sense or not. Do you want to have the Mueller investigation go on into 2022? I don't know. Maybe that's how long it would have taken to resolve whether or not you can force the president to come before you under oath.
You know, one other interesting thing, which I think is an important thing, is that Attorney General Barr said the conclusion that Mueller reached, that there was no criminality on the part of the president, obviously didn't come to a conclusion on obstruction of justice. He was either asked the question or offered on his own, I can't remember, was Mueller's decision based on the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department's memo that a sitting president can't be indicted, and Barr said the answer to that was no, meaning he didn't not find crimes were committed, he being Mueller, because he's precluded from indicting a sitting president by Justice Department policy, but allegedly on the merits themselves. So again, it's just been released. As the day goes along, we're going to talk to one of the higher-level members of Congress, Jim McGovern, Michael Zeldin, Andrew Cabral, a whole host of people who will have had an opportunity to digest this thing, and we'll do the best we can as the day goes along to do it ourselves.
And one last thing that was interesting, I thought, is the whole WikiLeaks thing, that Barr said that even if the Trump campaign colluded with WikiLeaks, that was not a crime. Remember how the president was saying during the campaign, and I love WikiLeaks. Mm. If WikiLeaks, you know, was urging if they had more dirt on Hillary Clinton, he didn't phrase it that way, but that's what he's talking about. But according to what Barr said, because WikiLeaks did not participate in the Russia's hacking of the emails involving Democrats, then its actions were no crime. So even if the Trump campaign did collude
and did disseminate
with WikiLeaks, that could not be an illegal conspiracy or collusion, even if they did collude, because there was no underlying crime.
877-301-8970. So most of you are flying like we are, having heard or seen the Attorney General's press conference this morning, but not having had an opportunity to read the actual report itself with whatever redactions they are. But we'll learn more as we go ahead, and we'll take your calls in the interim. Let's start in Providence with Kerry. Kerry on Boston Public Radio, Marge Regan and Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I'm calling because I just think that the press conference, the Attorney General's motivation and the audience that he was reaching with his comments was very telling. You know, that he never mentioned any Americans that were indicted in the investigation, just the Russians or Americans that are now in jail or are in other districts like the Southern District of New York for other prosecutions. You know, it's like he was just reaching out to a certain target audience that would agree with everything he was saying.
Well, forget the Southern District of New York, because obviously that's not Mueller's bailiwick. But you make a great point. He did go out of his way to mention the indictments of Russians, but he did not at all mention the indictment, in some case convictions, of people close to Donald Trump who happen to be Americans. That's a very good point. I have to say, I thought the thing was wildly partisan and frankly unnecessary. If it was this one of these things where there's an audience of one, the president of the United States? Did he order Barr to do this kind of press conference? He had already put out a letter and testified in front of Congress. Why not let the report speak for itself starting at 11 o'clock today?
Well, let's go back a little bit to what we talked about yesterday, back in 89 with Barr's...
when he ran the Office of Legal Counsel.
Yes, when he ran the Office of Legal Counsel, and he put out what seemed to be a biased report at that time. Let's talk about his 18 or 19-page memo saying that, downplaying any kind of obstruction of justice.
Can I interrupt you 1 second? Yes. CNN is reporting that in the report on collusion, this is Mueller on collusion, that the Trump campaign, quote, expected benefit from Russia's illegal actions. Again, obviously didn't rise to criminality, but, quote, the Trump campaign expected benefit from Russia's illegal actions.
Well,
I'm sorry.
That's new.
Yeah, I'd say so. 877-301-8970. Kerry, thank you for the call. Let's go to Mary on the road. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Listen, you know, Barr was a stand-up guy for years. He worked for Bush. This kind of behavior tells me one thing and one thing only. He was compromised at some point down the road. His whole thesis about the, you know, immunity of the president from prosecution, this whole thing has been a setup. It's pulling the strings again, guys. Congress, do something now, or our republic is lost.
Well, you know, it's Mary, you make a point that is obvious and hugely important. The fact, assuming that even if the Mueller report goes far further than Barr suggests it does, obviously, I assume he did not recommend any prosecution of the president, or else I don't think Barr would have cooked the book on that. None of the findings, none of the legal conclusions preclude Congress from acting. Again, we'll ask one of the highest ranking Democrats in Congress, the chair of the House Rules Committee, Jim McGovern from Worcester, what he thinks is the next step. But you are totally right. They can obviously can and will hold hearings. You know what's interesting? I'll play this a little bit later. James Clyburn, who I think is the number three, he is the number three ranking Democrat in the House, violated the Nancy Pelosi rule. He's on CNN last night and other places, and he talks about impeachment. Doesn't say we're going to do it, but talks about it. And as you know, the edict from Nancy Pelosi is that is off the table, and one of her key lieutenants is putting it back on the table, suggests that the dynamic may be changing. But again, nothing in this report, no matter what it says, precludes Congress from doing whatever it thinks is appropriate extra legally, meaning the impeachment provision of the Constitution is not a criminal statute. It is what it was. Gerald Ford who once said, impeachment is whatever Congress says it is.
I don't know who said it.
I think it was Gerald Ford.
So we have some people saying that this is a waste of time by the Democrats. Kate says this will distract the Democrats who are desperate to take down the president in any way, drag this out for another year instead of focusing on their own platform for 2020. 4 years of digging feverishly, wasting taxpayers' time and money instead of accepting the 2016 election. She predicts Trump will win again. Kevin, who is our big Trump friend from mm-hmm. New Hampshire, says he'll wait till he reads the report himself, but he feels this is a Democratic push to attack the president, to say the Russians influence his views or anybody else's are not true. He reads all the news and listens to left-leaning stations like ours, he says, and then the other side, and then makes up his mind.
You know what's going to be really interesting, speaking of advocates on either side of the Trump equation? I'm dying to see, after the report is sunk in a little bit, even if most people are not going to read 400 pages, but read all the accounts, listen and watch all the accounts, how many minds is it going to change in America? How many people are going to come to a different conclusion on any of the key issues than they had before they saw the report? I would bet very, very few.
Well, I think it's an interesting thing that people are on the president's side, even with things like we talked about with his complete denial of climate change as an issue, as we're just sitting here, like sitting ducks, getting hotter and hotter. That doesn't seem to bother people that support him either.
My 401k is doing very well.
Well, only half of Americans have 401ks.
No, but I'm saying, but I'm not getting in a debate with you. I'm just saying you hear a lot of people when they're interviewed the economy is perking along, that matters to me most.
But again, we have to go, but we should talk about that. Is that all that matters to people?
Well, people are entitled to decide whatever matters to them.
Okay.
Every single American can decide. Of course they
can. Okay, so it's all about bucks is basically what you're saying, and that's fine.
Somebody, climate change is all that it's about. Some, it's all about finances.
It's
all about corruption.
It's a whole cloth. But anyway, we got to take a break. We're talking about the Mueller report. We'll keep talking about it when we return. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 877-301-8970.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. About 15, 20 minutes ago, the Mueller report was released. It was handed to key congressional leaders and made available to the American public. You know what's weird? I just clicked on the link, and it is so almost an out-of-body experience. I've read a grand total of 15 words during the break. Report on the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, Volume 102, Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III, submitted pursuant to so-and-so. It really is odd. I mean, this has been such an intimate part of our lives for 2 years, almost 24/7, and it's there for the reading.
I would really like to find out, and we may not from this either. I'd like to find out why the Republican Party changed its platform regarding Russia. We assume at the behest of Paul Manafort, who is now in prison for a variety of crimes. I'd like to find out why people lied about their meetings with the Russians. Was it because they thought it looked bad? Or
it's a very good question.
You know, because that was one of the odd things. It made the president's team look guilty because they were acting guilty by lying about all these things. I don't know if we'll get those kind of answers and if that's part of the grand jury testimony, which we're not going to see, at least not for a while. I think we will eventually see it. But I'd love to know that.
877-301-8970. Brunier in Hyde Park. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
Hi. I think it's a sad day today, really, because I feel like the United States is going to banana republic territory very fast with these morons in the White House. sorry, guys. It's really I'm feeling very sad. I mean,
yeah, me too.
How could you have the Attorney General, who's supposed to be the guardian of our laws, and this guy is just using a bunch of technicalities to get this president off? There is no collusion. That's true. But, I mean, there's no conspiracy. It's true. But there is collusion. And he's conflating collusion with conspiracy for those of us who are unwashed and uneducated. You know, there is collusion. There is no conspiracy because the collusion did not rise to the level of conspiracy, which is a legal term. And most people are going to confuse that. And he's using the same vocabulary as Trump. It's sad.
Well, unfortunately, no one comes into these discussions clean because I think virtually everybody in America, Bernier, has decided which side they're on vis-a-vis Donald Trump. But I like to think if one had an open mind, which very few do, you couldn't watch that press conference and feel good about the presentation of Barr, even if you liked the conclusions he reached, because it was, I'm just rereading during the break some of the things he said, so clearly partisan and unnecessary. As I said, by my count, at least seven times he said the words no collusion or no conspiracy. It was almost like Trump himself or Rudy Giuliani, even though Barr looks sane as opposed to Rudy Giuliani. Yeah. So I agree with you. It was not for those who believe in a rule of law and want their attorney general, even though part of the president's cabinet, to be the independent chief law enforcement officer of the country. It was not a great moment. Bernier, thank you for the call. I mean, the reality is Loretta Lynch, how upset were most of us, even if we were Obama fans or
did she talk to Clinton
when
on
that runway thing was totally inappropriate and totally bad judgment. I'm not equating. Please don't call in with an equivalency thing. I'm not suggesting that.
Okay.
I'm saying attorneys general have to go out of their way in every possible way to show that they are not an extension, an arm of the president. They're not Donald Trump or Barack Obama's personal lawyers. They are the American people's lawyers.
When Bernier talks about a republic, what he's saying to me and identify with is that's what this president has done. He's turned, there was a great story the other day about Nick Mulvaney and the Elizabeth Warren's consumer agency that she started and was originally going to head, but people wouldn't allow her to head it. It didn't go over well in Congress. How the protections for us consumers have been systematically taken away by this president. You know, it's easier. You can't, if you're getting screwed by a credit card company, if you're getting screwed by a for-profit college, if you're getting screwed by a hospital, whatever it is, they're taking away those protections. They're taking those away. Later on, we're going to find out that people at the border, we're going to talk about Andrew Cabral with this, that now people who are legally seeking asylum because they, and if you read the story about what goes on in Honduras 2 weeks ago, it would turn your stomach, which is the reason why women and babies are fleeing to the border, even if they can't get in. What he's trying to do to asylum seekers is take away their ability to get bail. So they are stranded with their children for months and months and months
waiting for their asylum.
So it's this permeation of cruelty and kind of like it's like he's out to get the average Americans. And that part of his presidency is what is even more upsetting to me than a lot of this stuff. This idea that for some reason, I don't know what he's angry at. I don't know why he feels he needs to be so cruel, but that's what he is.
You know, the other thing, for the second time I'll say it's going to get totally lost in the shuffle, is reaffirmation from the Attorney General of the United States that there was Russian interference. There essentially is one person
which is
the
still
United
going
States,
on, by the way.
One person in the United States who is in denial of the Russian interference. And most people think it's because it's if it is true, which it is, then it means that Donald Trump could be an illegitimate president. I am surely not arguing that, but people close to Trump say that that's what his fear is.
Right.
That if, yes, there was Russian interference, and if it was effective, there were three states that were very close, then maybe it's only because of the Russians that Donald Trump is president. According to his friends, that's his greatest
fear. And by
the
way, one last thing, you know, Kevin just emailed and said he was, you know, none of this Russian stuff interfere with his view of things. But it's very clever and very smart. What it talked about is stirring your upset, say, about race relations in America, blowing up stories about African-Americans doing horrible things, blowing them all out of proportion, and then having them
some
repeated.
Some of the Facebook postings by the Russians.
Yes, and then having them repeated. Or talking about the terrible crimes that illegal immigrants supposedly committed. And when you look at them, a lot of they're not. I mean, Americans are committing much more crimes. But appealing to your base emotions in ways that are very smart and very subtle. And that was what the Russian interference was about in 2016, 2018, and probably again in 2020, trying to split you apart over these hot-button issues. Let's go to John from Gardner. Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Hey, kids. First of all, can you guys ask Art Kaplan what he supposes, what drugs they gave Rod Rosenstein to zombieize him and reduce his blink rate to once every 97 seconds?
By the way, Trump wanted him fired, too, speaking
That's
of
right.
obstruction of justice.
And Rosenstein supposedly talked about wearing a wire because he
I know.
Thought the president
We didn't
lost
hear that this
marbles.
Morning. That's right.
I don't think the prospects are very likely, but this guy knows where all the bodies are buried. I would love to have some way of knowing what's in his head. I want to just mention quickly, Fox people have been emphasizing bigly that nobody in the White House requested redactions. They seem to be pushing that big point.
Well, by the way, John, stop. Sorry. That is a big point, by the way.
Yes,
if
is.
His lawyers had access to it, which they did, both his personal lawyers and his White House lawyers, I don't think there's anybody questioning that the White House lawyers should get a look at this. His personal lawyers is another story. The fact, sure. assuming Barr's telling the truth and they didn't request any changes, I think is not only of significance, but good. But next point.
Okay, I'll throw these out real quick and you sure. get rid of me or talk. I found it interesting. You mentioned collusion and conspiracy. He also threw in cooperation. At
he
various
did, yep.
times, he described it as no collusion, no conspiracy, no cooperation.
He did.
There are going to be those 10 instances of possible obstruction that we can all look at, assumably, if it's not too redacted. Barr said that he did not discuss with Mueller who Mueller expected to make the decision, i.e., Mueller or Congress.
Oh, no, you mean i.e. Barr or Congress.
Correct.
Yeah.
And he said he didn't discuss that with Mueller, which I find curious. And lastly, this emotional motivations business. He stated categorically that's in Mueller's report. So we're also, again, depending on redactions, going to be able to see if that's true or not.
That is
but
correct.
Lastly,
yeah, go ahead,
I
quickly.
Tried to give this guy a fair shot, but this is a joke, this Barr business.
Well, you know, someone else I'm standing across from went out of her way to give Barr a strong shot, a fair shot. That would be Marjorie Egan. Thank you, John. And no, you did. No, I don't mean that critically of you. I think it was important. You have to have faith in somebody who's going to be honorable and play fair. And the conventional wisdom, and I happen to share it on the margins, was that this guy would. And keep in mind, as Marjorie said a couple of minutes ago, we talked to you yesterday about this 1989 Office of Legal Counsel memo drafted by Barr, which Barr did. He was head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the time. And the full report, the findings that Barr concluded, was not released until Clinton took office 3 years later. And any objective reader would draw the conclusion Barr cooked the books. Now, the good news is, if this is only lightly redacted, we will be able to tell in the next few hours or maybe by the end of the day where Barr told the truth and where he bent the truth a little bit, both in his letter, his testimony, and in the press conference this morning. By the way, we're going to spend a huge part of the day talking about this with you and with guests.
Yes, we are. Matter of fact, we're going to get right back to it after we talk to Art Kaplan. We'll return to the Mueller report at noon. But meanwhile, we are going to talk to Art Kaplan, the nothingness of workplace wellness programs. New research finds these programs are not doing their job when it comes to making employees healthier and cutting costs. We'll talk to him about that and much more. Our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, joins us next. And then it's back to All Mueller, all the time. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So Ohio is the latest state to pass a heartbeat bill, which would ban abortions as early as 6 weeks. The laws are unlikely to go into effect anytime soon, and similar bans have been struck down in court, but anti-abortion activists say the legal challenges are the point. Their strategy is to use the heartbeat bill as a template to overturn Roe v. Wade. Joining us to talk about this, the all-important 15-second hand sanitizer rule, how workplace wellness programs are falling down. Well, this is a disaster. And more is Art Kaplan. Art is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Hey, Art Kaplan.
Hello, hello. Washing my hands as we speak.
I hope so.
So tell us about these so-called fetal heartbeat abortion bans. We mentioned Ohio. We're also talking about Kentucky doing it, Mississippi doing it, Iowa, North Dakota have similar measures. Georgia's about to do it. This seems like it's going on everywhere.
It is, and it's part of a strategy. These laws have been ruled unconstitutional because in Roe versus Wade, abortion was permitted up until viability, normally defined around 23 weeks of fetal development. After that, the fetus, in theory, can live outside the woman's body. Now, by the way, that's because lungs develop. But the heartbeat bills are basically giving the court an opportunity to overturn Roe versus Wade. They know that, again and again, that 24-week viability standard has been upheld, but they're basically going to the court with its new appointees and saying, take a look again, see if you want to redefine this. Maybe you want to move it down to the appearance of the first heartbeat. By the way, appearance of the first heartbeat doesn't mean that the fetus is independent from the mom. So still relying on the mom's circulation, even though the heart may be doing something, it's not able to support the fetus. So I'm not sure that's a good place to draw the line.
You know, what does the medical community anticipate should the courts overturn Roe v. Wade? In states like Massachusetts, the state law will supersede federal law, and abortions will be able to, women will be able to get abortions in Massachusetts and certain other states. But what's going to happen?
What would happen is in many states there'd be no surgical abortion facilities. Women would have to travel to another state to get an abortion, and in the states that permit it, you'd certainly have some advertising or recruitment of come here, you know, this is a place you can get this particular medical procedure. But I've said, you know, forever, we keep repeating it, I think what you'd see in the states that get restrictive is the appearance of telemedicine with day-after pills and pharmaceutical abortions with people shipping those pills into those states. It wouldn't be, you know, it's likely that somebody's going to try and ban that.
Well, they're trying, aren't they? Aren't they already trying?
Sure. They are. They probably are listening to the show and they hear me keep saying it. But the problem is they're interfering with interstate commerce, which, you know, is our ultimate key value, that we don't do that. Whatever, we may kill each other and end fetal life and do many things, but we certainly don't want to be interfering with interstate commerce. So.
Okay.
I'm with you on that one, Art. Let me tell you.
Okay.
So I think those things will not get anywhere. You start to say you can't ship X, and Google and Amazon and eBay and so on start to go crazy saying, well, then what's next? You're going to start restricting us from shipping this or this or that or that. It will lead to a very different alliance than you usually see around abortion battles.
You know, one last thing on this. I know it's a tired theme on the show, but it matters to both me and Marjorie. For those who say false alarm, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had cancer, what, three times?
Yep.
She's in her mid-80s. The second oldest justice from across the river, Steve Breyer, is either 79 or 80. It is not absurd to think that even a one-term Donald Trump could get one or two more picks which almost, in my opinion, would seal the deal. I know you think, or at least used to think, Marjorie, that a court would, for political reasons, would never outlaw it. They just make it virtually impossible
to get. Yeah, I may
be
totally wrong. But although you do wonder, I'm not a lawyer, Jim, you are.
You're not, I didn't
but
know that.
You do, what happens in other places, other countries, and prior to Roe v. Wade, is that women of means were always able to get abortions. Poor women weren't because they didn't have the money to travel.
Same in this country.
Right. So I'm wondering about equal protection under the law kind of thing.
No, actually, it's interesting to say that because I know Clarence Thomas is really concerned about that and the interstate commerce clause. I think those are the two things he really holds dear.
I don't know. Maybe John Roberts is. I don't know.
In any case, we're talking Art Kappel.
I mean, I will say this in terms of the court. I think it would be very unlikely, my prediction, to overturn Roe v. Wade. But what I do think they'll start to tolerate is regulation of abortion clinics so that, you know, you have to have basically become a hospital and you have to have all kinds of fancy equipment there and you have to have fully trained specialists there. And so I think the way to expect change is not for them to throw out something that's been affirmed, I don't know, many times in prior decisions, but to start to say states have the right to, quote-unquote, regulate the clinics, and that would de facto achieve this.
Right. You have a constitutional right to abortion, but unfortunately you can't access it. I mean, that is obviously. We're talking Art Kappel.
So, Art Kappel, this story surprised me. I didn't realize that people were going to 23andMe to find out about serious DNA issues like the tests that the mutation that makes you more likely to get breast cancer.
This has been going on for a long time, probably close to 8 or 9 years now. The companies like 23andMe or other online direct-to-consumer genetic testing things, you know, we commonly associate them with the importance of finding out whether you should wear a lederhosen or a beret.
Exactly.
Big on ancestry testing. But and I wear both, just to be safe. never can be too safe. But but the general health information, they were offering that too for a long time, get tested for health risks. And there was a big battle with the FDA about whether they were accurate enough. And then the FDA decided to let them do the BRCA1 testing. But a lot of experts say it's still not accurate enough. They're only testing for a couple of genetic mutations, a couple of changes in genes. And risk factors go beyond that, so you could get a negative test and still be at risk. And we also don't fully understand, certainly at the level of testing that those companies do, what the interactions are between the breast cancer risk genes and other genes. So, yeah, it's basically, I don't know, if you had a lot of breast cancer in your family and it was early onset and your mother had it and your aunt had it and your grandmom had it, I think you want to go to a genetic counselor, not be using stuff that you pick up from commercials on TV.
We're talking to Art Kappel. So, Art, there's good news and bad news on this next story. The good news is that more than 80% of employers with more than 200 workers have some sort of wellness program that they offer to their employees, you know, like smoking cessation or whatever. The bad news is they don't work. So... I have mixed feelings about this. This is a report in the Journal of the American Medical Association published a couple of days ago. Could you break down the findings for us, please?
Well, basically, they took a look. I think they were at BJ Wholesale.
They were, yeah.
Employees. Yep. I think that's what they were studying. But it was a large number, tens of thousands of them. And they basically confirm something that's been popping up in other studies. So when employee wellness programs say, you know, we're going to give you, I don't know, $10 a month if you lower your blood pressure a few points or drop some weight, those programs don't seem to really move behavior very much. And even when they move behavior a little bit, like the 5-point drop in blood pressure, it doesn't seem to have any big health impact because it's not a big enough change. So a lot of businesses are all wound up about wellness programs. I never trust them because I still worry that you're getting some surveillance of you by the boss.
I totally agree.
And I think it's more risky than it is helpful. The other problem, by the way, with the wellness programs, and both of you know about this from working at the sweatshop that you're at, If they make you stand, or if you had to have repetitive stress injury because you were working a keyboard all day, well, maybe the employer doesn't care about that so much, right? At NYU, I might say, gosh, you stress me out. You have a wellness program that lets me incentivizes me to lose weight, but mentally I'm all stressed out because you make me talk to students, and you know what they're like, and they're horrible. So I'm getting mentally stressed, but my employer doesn't care because that's my job, so I have to do it. You see what I'm saying? It's like you may have to hammer the same nail every day, and you start getting repetitive stress injury, but the employer isn't going to put in a wellness program for that.
You know, Art, I think we've talked to you in the past, prior to this more definitive study about the whether these things work. I have to say, I was always skeptical, with one exception. You mentioned like $10 a month to do so-and-so, or, you know, you get a discount at a health club. Mm-hmm. That doesn't do much for me. I've always believed that if you – I don't mean this as a joke, by the way – that if you pay serious money, which I assume would save serious money for an employer if it worked – you know, putting aside the surveillance thing, which deeply covers me, concerns me too, that if you paid serious money to employ, speaking for myself, I make a very decent living. If I was paid X dollars to lose 10 pounds or to go to a gym three times a week,
yeah,
it would increase the likelihood of my doing that like exponentially. Am I an aberration or no?
No, you're onto something, because paying tiny incentives, little rewards, just doesn't move behavior. Even if you're sort of not earning huge wages, you've got to start to make significant monetary rewards to get somebody to, say, give up the ice cream or do something that they dearly love or do something they don't really want to do, like go walk a mile at lunchtime and stuff like that. They won't do it if you just hand them $3.
So,
do you know what, actually, if I may interrupt just quickly, a new program, I don't know if it's been officially announced by the mm-hmm. people at GBH, the managers here. You can get as much as $50 a month. I don't know if you know about this, Marjorie, if you memorize the Interstate Commerce Clause and can recite it without – did you know – I don't know if other employers
right.
are doing that.
We have to be ready.
One of us is ready.
It's going to be big, like bigger, biggest.
It's like a Chinese truth camp you meet every Friday at 3 for the recitation.
Exactly. Yeah. So, Art Kaplan, I've heard a lot about this pregnancy tracking app, Ovia, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, that a lot of young mothers are using now. And it sounded pretty neat to me, but now I'm learning of this terrible downside.
Yeah. So I haven't seen this app firsthand. I've read about it. I have not actually looked at it. But apparently it tracks your pregnancy.
Yeah.
And it may, in fact, track your monthly periods, and this information is supplied back to you. So they may try to tell you to eat better, or what to do if you're feeling crampy, or what to do if you miss a period, that sort of thing. So all nice, but they're feeding the information, and they say non-identified, back to not only your boss, but also they're selling it to third parties, other outfits that want to send you ads for tampons or...
Don't forget, it monitors your sex drive, too. So your boss...
That's true, by the way.
Your
boss, enter that in the ad.
Exactly. Your boss wants to know about that.
I don't mean to be crazy, but really? You're going to type in your sexual activity on the app? I mean, I know people do a lot of stuff like I'm drunk and I'm at a party on Facebook, but... monitor your sexual activity?
Well,
really?
I guess
people are going to do that?
I guess they're talking about when they're pregnant. Are they more interested in the sex when they're 3 months pregnant or 5 months pregnant? What are they doing when they're 9 months pregnant?
I can only repeat myself.
Okay. Okay.
So, but my point is, and it's a little bit related to what we're talking about, workplace wellness. This is a version of that. It's just a subset of what we were just griping about. I don't trust that this information couldn't be hacked. I don't trust that it couldn't erroneously get, by mistake, leaked. I don't trust that it couldn't be sold to somebody who doesn't treat it with the same privacy. I just don't trust it. So whatever the benefits are here, and they don't seem to me to be big, the opportunity to get marketed products and stuff like that. I think you should get monitored by your OBGYN.
Yeah.
You know, can I review quickly, if I may? So the Ohio governor signs a bill that he is hoping that ultimately leads to the repeal of Roe v. Wade, taking
Correct.
Away the rights of millions of poor women across this country. 23andMe is giving fraudulent results on breast cancer. Employee wellness programs don't work. And all the information you enter on a pregnancy app is going to be shared with Mark Zuckerberg.
Exactly. I mean, your boss is spying on your sex life.
It's just, it is
my
really.
My comment is, good times for bioethics. Enter my field.
That is true. Well, now, this is a really important
exactly.
one to us.
The we've been discussing. Time to bring this subject in.
Why is it?
Hand sanitizing.
Why is it a perfect
well,
time?
Well, after all the other things we've been talking about.
Oh, it is. Well, we have been, Marjorie and I have been on the radio almost 20 years, and we've only talked about hand sanitizer about 300 times. And one of the reasons is one of our former producers, who's now a cop.
A cop.
By the way, we just saw him a couple of weeks ago. What was he there for? Oh, the Patriots,
Patriots
the Super
Parade.
Bowl parade.
Yep.
It was that constant presentation of illegality that drove him to police
so.
Work.
Marjorie jokingly says to him, we hadn't seen him in a few years, she says, John, where's the bottle of Purell? And he taps his pants pocket and he says, right here, as always.
That's
so
right.
Tell us what the WHO, I guess, is the organization, World Health Organization, that is proposing a certain method of using the sanitizer. And then after you tell us what they say, tell us if you're a recommender, if you think this actually works or this is an obsession well beyond its utility. Go ahead.
So the WHO, looking at certain studies, has found that if you magically wave your hands above the container of Purell, it does not kill bacteria. Followed by a study that shows if you just splash it on your hand, wipe it a little bit around and run away and do your thing, that doesn't work. They want 15 seconds of hand washing. By the way, that's kind of true for washing your hands in the sink with soap, too. If you just run them under the faucet, as I see people do, and I've done myself, you know, oh, I wash my hands, sure. Boop. And ran away, that doesn't work because you got to scrub your hands. Stuff is, you know, under your fingernails and all this sort of thing. So does Purell work? Yeah, there seems to be a lot of evidence that it does. But just running around sort of daintily exposing your digits to that is not going to cut the mustard. And I know Jim knows this because I'm sure he's rubbing that stuff on him 24/7 and, you know, making sure that all crevices and cracks are attended to.
Well, next time I use Purell will be the first time. You know, are you one of those people? We only know you from afar.
What are you doing?
I wash my hands like normal people did before.
All,
no, I don't. And I don't go to the supermarket
and, we don't use
and
the
wipe the whole cart down before I go shopping either.
Oh,
do you?
Do?
No, I do not.
If I was going to the supermarket, bring some Purell. Once you push the cart around, use it. I don't think you're going to have hand washing there. That's a good place to use it. Bad advice from Jim. Don't listen
to that. Wait a second. Are you one of those nutty, like, Purell people?
Sounds like
or
it.
Are you or not?
Sounds like it. In his lederhosen.
Nutty. I beg to differ with that description. I would say prudent.
I'd love to see Art in lederhosen.
When I have my airplane trip and I know that the tray is dirty, I try to wipe it down if I've got something. Otherwise, I wash my hands with Purell frequently since I probably can't fit into the 1-foot by 1-foot bathroom that now exists. And, supermarket visit, there's no hand washing there. Those carts are filthy, and I would use it, you know, when I'm done with the cart and before I get in the car. Yeah.
Are you a bit Purell?
By the way, we use it in a hospital.
No.
Well, a
it's
hospital
in every
is
room in our
well,
hospital.
A hospital is a little different. I mean, are you one of these people, too?
I believe in loading up in a lot of bacteria.
What, to create an immunity
seems
or something?
Seems to work well. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, I used to be a teacher in a daycare.
I finally convinced Marjorie that nature is good, but get infected.
I don't know.
No, I use it. I mean, it has its place. I'm not saying washing your hands is bad. That's a good thing to do, too. But as Jim knows, you often are places where you can't do that.
That's correct.
You know, Art Kaplan, this next story is my favorite story of the week.
Me
the
too,
new
by
study
the way.
Finds
a simple
way to inoculate teens against junk food marketing. What they're basically doing in this story is telling, and it works, I guess, better with the boys, telling these kids that the adults, once again, are lying to them and trying to convince them to eat all this bad food. And it's just a bunch of baloney.
Not just the adults, the big bad corporations are lying to them.
Yeah. We don't want them to eat a bunch of baloney either.
Exactly. And then it works much better than all these kind of, you know, healthy food lessons and four food groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is brilliant.
It's so funny. I mean, basically, it's playing to the reality that teenagers like to be rebellious.
Yes.
So instead of giving them the goody-goody message, you know, here's the nutrition profile, and if you eat these vegetables, you get useful calories, and this is the junk stuff, and you don't eat that because it's high calories and no nutrition, and the kids are all rolling their eyes and reaching out for a Twinkie or something, or, you know, trying to eat something junky. They basically say, you know, these companies are lying to you and ripping you off, right? You do know that. They're just giving you a line of baloney about their products. And the kids basically say, well, then I'm not going to be taken advantage of. I'm not going to let those authorities lie to me. And they balk back and they eat better. So hooray for the discovery of adolescence.
But, you know, it really is good. So can are you buying this, by the way, this research, or is it too sort of...
I would like to see it confirmed a little more.
Yeah,
it
me
seems
too.
Almost too good to be true.
Yeah.
But it does appeal. I like the fact that it's trying to work with teenager psychology. You know, don't tell me all
me
the
too.
Good stuff. Tell me why someone's trying to jerk me around and I'll fight back.
No, it's true. It's...
I know. It's much like being a parent of a teen.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, this is out of the university. Do we say this? University of Chicago
methods.
Booth School of Business, whatever that thing is.
So, businessmen getting into health information there. Watch out. They'll pretty soon make an app and monitor your pregnancy. But anyway.
So what are you doing on the, the Everyday Ethics podcast there?
Well,
what
are you doing? We went through this whole visit today, and we didn't once mention vaccines.
Yep.
But they continue to be a problem in terms of measles outbreaks. And so we did do an episode on the justification for mandating vaccination and why, by the way, we're not really the vaccine police don't come and drag your kid out and vaccinate them. But why you get fines, why you close schools, you really have to have the authority, and I support it, for the health department to say, we got a measles epidemic, we got to get on top of it, and your right to say no is going to be restricted.
But did we not say last week with you that the Rockland County in New York, first of the nation, kind of you can't go out, essentially, if you're unvaccinated. Didn't a New York State court strike it down?
They did, and I think it was stupid and ridiculous, and they're back in court to get it put back. They today passed another effort, and New York City has the same thing. They're getting sued, too.
Right.
So, if you will, the podcast basically says the judges better pay attention. You don't wait for an epidemic to declare a public health emergency. You prevent them.
Sounds good to us. We'll be listening. Art Kaplan, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Wash your hands, everybody.
We will be.
Thank you very much, Art Kaplan. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's a Doctors William F. Virginia Conley Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Coming up, the Mueller report is out. Andrea Cabral joins us for her take on this and some other law enforcement issues, including on Mueller. Is the complete exoneration of the president here or not? That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, 1 hour ago, William Barr released the redacted version of the Mueller report. Has Barr chosen to make most of his account public? Has he excised large parts of the Mueller report, which could lead to a legal battle between House Democrats and the Trump administration? Will Barr define his legacy as Trump's AG or as the AG for the people of the United States? At noon, Andrew Cabral joins us for this on today's special edition of Law & Order. From there, we talk to legal analyst and former Mueller colleague Michael Zeldin about the redacted report and why Mueller's team could not reach a conclusion about whether the president obstructed justice.
After William Barr released the four-page summary of the Mueller report, Congressman Jim McGovern, along with other House Democrats, demanded the release of the full Mueller report. We'll ask McGovern if these redactions went too far. Then Alex Beam joins us for some relief with his famous explainer, what happened to Julian Assange's cat and who's taking care of the cat now? That's next on Boston Public Radio. He Eastern Brody. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, hour number two. Hello again, Jim.
That was really relaxing 7 or 8 minutes, I should say. Here with us in Studio 3 for Law & Order, the Mueller Report edition, is Andrew Cabral. Andrew is the former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety, current CEO of Ascend. Andrea, it is nice to see you.
It is nice to be here.
Can I just read, Marjorie and Andrea, one little thing that has nothing to do with the evidence, just an interesting anecdotal thing from the report. And we're doing what you're doing at home or at your office, is reading as fast as we can. And obviously we'll continue to give updates as our coworkers in the control room learn things. In May 2017, then Attorney General Jeff Sessions told Trump that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had just appointed Mueller a special counsel. Trump slumped back in his chair, according to notes from Jody Hunt, Jeff Sessions' chief of staff, quote, "Oh my God, this is terrible. This is the end of my presidency. I'm effed," Trump said. Trump further laid into Sessions for his recusal, saying Sessions had let him down. What did you find that stuck out for you, Marjorie?
Well, in terms of collusion, which Barr said the president was totally cleared of, I mean, it looks to me—
By Mueller, he said.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking that they have a very legal definition of what collusion is, that it's not just two parties taking actions informed by or responsive to the other's action and interests. They didn't reach— It's more than that. You have to almost sit down and have a contract that you're going to collude together, and that's not a legal thing. That's my interpretation of it. But anyway, Mueller made abundantly clear that Russia wanted to help the Trump campaign, and the Trump campaign was willing to take it. Here's a quote from the Mueller investigation. "Although the investigation established that the Russian government perceived it would benefit from a Trump presidency and worked to secure that outcome, and that the Trump campaign expected it would benefit electorally from information stolen and released through Russian efforts, the investigation nonetheless did not establish that members of the Trump campaign, according to that legal definition, conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its interference activities." And you're seeing the same things about obstruction of justice, which the Mueller team struggled over much more. They report that it seemed that the president was saved from more serious legal jeopardy in this regard by his own staffers, who frequently refused to carry out his orders because they thought they were either problematic or illegal. So I've just started it, but it's not looking very good so far.
Well, and we should make clear, Andrew Cabral, that even though Mueller did not come to a conclusion on obstruction of justice, and the Attorney General and Rod Rosenstein concluded that there hadn't been obstruction of justice as a matter of law, meaning as a criminal act by the president, Congress, once it digests this thing, could determine that the president did obstruct justice for constitutional impeachment reasons, and they could move against them, correct?
Not? Not only is all of this abundant and ample evidence of impeachable material, not only could he be impeached, Rosenstein and Barr are drawing conclusions of fact that are generally left to a jury. Why aren't they being left to a jury? Because the DOJ has a policy that you can't indict a sitting president, which weighed heavily in Mueller's estimation as to whether or not he could draw a conclusion on a couple of these issues.
So, well, let me just correct one thing there. At least according to Barr, and again, we haven't read this in the report, Barr did say at his press conference this morning that Mueller, I think through an intermediary, not one-on-one, am I correct, Marjorie? Mueller made clear that his finding of no criminal activity was not based upon the Office of Legal Counsel's opinion in the Justice Department that he can't indict a sitting president. At least that's what Barr said. We haven't read Mueller's actual words.
I'm sorry. You'll have to forgive me if I take absolutely nothing that Bill Barr says at face value after he issues essentially a four-page interpretation of a 400-page report that even Mueller's own people said was misleading. Why anybody is quoting this man on anything, you know, is beyond me. But what I still don't understand, and what troubles me greatly, is why Mueller accepted written answers from the president and didn't subpoena him. It makes no sense. You cannot come to the conclusion that you can't discern a person's intent when the means and mechanism for discerning that intent is in front of you. And you could exercise it. You could use it. You choose not to. You allow written answers only as to one of the questions that you're seeking to answer, and then say that you can't discern the intent. And I find that troubling. All of that said, I think Mueller intended to put the ball firmly in Congress's court. It is firmly in Congress's court. They have waited too long as it is, and impeachment proceedings should start immediately.
Here is the CNN summary of the exact issue you just raised. The special counsel believed it had the authority to subpoena President Trump, but decided against doing so because it would delay the investigation, according to the report. The prosecutors also believed they already had a substantial amount of evidence. Quote, we made the decision in view of the substantial delay that such an investigative step would likely produce at a later stage in our investigation, the special counsel wrote in his report. We had sufficient evidence to understand relevant events and to make certain assessments without the president's testimony. I have to say, I am fixated since last night on what you're fixated on. If it turns out the issue is the inability to discern intent, even though I would suggest when you read the report,
yes, I
and
agree.
See he calls Jeff Sessions at home and says, can you please unrecuse yourself, or calls McGahn at home and his former counsel and says, please go fire Mueller, the special counsel. It seems, I don't know if impute is the right word, that you're the former prosecutor, that you can impute intent by the action
it
itself.
Can be inferred.
And if you
can be.
You then call the person whose intent you're trying to discern, the president. And I have to say, I am totally unpersuaded that the special counsel made the right decision because of delay. He is obviously right. There would have been a long delay. But I don't think it was for him to make a political decision about whether a delay was too long if the critical witness was the one who refused to come before you. And let's repeat, if we may, and I'm sorry, if you tuned in at 11, I'm sorry to repeat this. The exact words from William Barr this morning at his press conference at 9:35, the president of the White House took no act that deprived special counsel of witnesses and documents. Well, that's simply not true. The one act they took that did deprive the special counsel of a witness was the refusal to have the president of the United States be a witness before the special counsel.
Which other presidents have done. Clearly, you can subpoena a sitting president because I believe Bill Clinton was subpoenaed for the deposition that he took.
I don't know if that was in the civil case or was that in the Justice Department? I'm not 100% sure.
I can't. But I thought it was for Ken Starr's investigation.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I'm just not sure.
But so maybe if they think that the delay would have been because it would, you know, he would have challenged a move to quash the subpoena and it would have gone up. I have a feeling that the Supreme Court of the United States would have taken a direct appeal on this to move it along
without going through the normal appellate process.
Exactly.
Right, which
that
they can
said,
do. That's a good point.
To me, the idea that you're refusing a subpoena to go in and tell people, tell the special counsel that you're not guilty of this, that in and of itself is damning. I mean, other presidents certainly have known before they've given statements in any one of a number of forums under oath that they exposed themselves to jeopardy, but they went and they did it. Every step of the way, it doesn't make a difference what you're talking about, his tax returns, this investigation, he has attempted to thwart it at every step. And what is amazing to me is that I think we've seen obstruction of justice in plain view, right in our faces, day after day, month after month since he's been president. And for this to, you know, for Mueller to sort of be unable to come to that conclusion on any basis other than DOJ policy that you can't indict a president is just stunning to me.
Here's another relevant passage. We all wondered what would the conclusions be about the infamous Trump Tower meeting. And here's part of it, only a small part of it, from the report. On at least three occasions in late June and early July of 2017, as the story was surfacing publicly in the press about the June of 2016 Trump Tower meeting, Trump, quote, directed spokeswoman Hope Hicks and others, quote, not to publicly disclose information about the meeting. This was after Hicks had warned Trump that, quote, the email setting up the June 9th meeting of last year was, quote, really bad and the story would be, quote, massive. Now, again, you have rendered an opinion. We'll ask Michael Zeldmoy, thinks, why can you not read intent into that? What other intent could he have that he doesn't want to upset the public while they're trying to enjoy their summer in 2017?
It's happening in courtrooms all across this country. In thousands and thousands of courtrooms, prosecutors are standing before juries and asking them to infer an individual defendant's intent from all
based
of their
on
actions.
His or her actions.
Exactly.
Right. You did that
exactly.
all the time, I assume.
Constantly.
Right.
There
right.
was
what,
no
you
know, reason why it can't be it, done
when,
here.
When you mentioned Bill Clinton before, I believe that Bill Clinton obstructed justice because he lied about sex.
Right. Exactly.
Something millions of Americans have probably
yeah.
done.
Suddenly
or
the
are
bar
doing.
Is just much, much, much
yeah,
higher.
Because what you're getting here is that Mueller found numerous instances of very bizarre behavior involving Russia and numerous instances of obstruction of justice, but they did not rise to the level of a crime. Listen to this. When I said before that the report shows that Trump was saved by his staff from illegal activities, they say in the early days of his administration, when the president was facing growing questions about then National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's conversation about sanctions with the Russian ambassador, the president ordered aide Katie McFarlane. Remember her? She was that blonde that was oftentimes on Fox News. Well, she was. If people just want to point that out, they might remember she had blonde hair. Anyway, Katie McFarlane to write. They do. That's a very good point. It's a rare brunette who makes it up to Fox News. Well, she's not employed by Fox News, not yet. No. Anyway, maybe she is, actually. Is she working for Murdoch? I think she might be.
Know.
Anyway, KT McFarlane, he ordered her to write an email saying that he did not direct those conversations involving Flynn. But KT McFarlane didn't do it because she wasn't sure if the president was telling her the truth, and she feared it might be improper and she'd be left holding the bag.
Here's another question. So it doesn't rise to the level of a crime. Has no one heard of the crime of attempt? The fact that you are thwarted by your staff from furthering a crime does not mean that you haven't made an overt act, like, say, the picking up of a telephone and the calling of a cabinet secretary at night asking them to do your dirty work for you and to either unrecuse themselves or fire someone else. I haven't read this whole thing, but attempt is a crime. To attempt to commit a crime is a crime well as the actual commission of it. I just don't see how the volume of this evidence didn't lead them to make a conclusion. And I do understand if he decided to put it in Congress's court, right? Mm-hmm. I think that should have been really prominent. I think the first part of the report should have said which you will read, we're just letting you know, we think that this is more properly the purview of Congress to, proceed with however Congress should proceed with, even if they don't have to mention the word impeachment. I don't understand how he could have come to the conclusion that he did apart from that.
They got a chiron up on CNN now that says obstruction. This Mueller said obstruction by Trump failed because staffers refused to carry out his orders.
That's an attempt. That doesn't mean there's not an overt act.
A couple of things that are actually fair-minded from a Barr this morning at about 9:30 that I think are reports on responsible behavior, either by Barr himself or by the Trump administration. One, during the question and answer after Barr's maybe 20-minute presentation, he was asked if he had any problem with Robert Mueller testifying in front of Congress. Would he try to stop him? And the answer was no, that he had no problem with it. That's important. The congressional leaders have said they want to see him on Capitol Hill by May 23rd. I don't know why so long.
Yeah, me
and
either.
And hopefully he'll be there by then. Secondly, that while the president's both official counsel, White House counsel, and his personal counsel, I don't understand the latter thing very well, did see the redacted report before. More good news, I think, for transparency, is according to William Barr, assuming it's true, there were no requests to invoke executive privilege by the White House and no requested change. By the way, his personal lawyers, who also got the redacted version, according to Barr, requested no changes. So, that, again, all three of those acts, I think, are pro-transparency.
I don't believe a word of that.
What? You don't think it's true?
No.
You think he's making up what?
I think that there are ways to communicate what you want. I mean, the infamous Michael Cohen talked about him speaking in code. People know exactly what it is that he wants. Barr knows exactly what
it is that he wants.
That's how he knew to have an audition memo to get the job.
Last
Barr knows exactly what he wants.
That's the 19-page memo saying that the president can't obstruct justice.
Who shows a potential target's private attorney the results of the investigation ahead of time?
Well, it was a very
showing his attorney is the same as showing Trump.
The very interesting. Well, obviously, when the White House counsel get it, they get it. But Dana Bash on CNN did some interesting research this morning. The attorney general was asked a question. I don't have it verbatim about whether or not it was standard procedure to release a redacted report like this. Now, of course, there's not much precedent, as he made the point, to the personal lawyers, not the White House lawyers of someone like the president. And he said that essentially it was not unusual practice. But Dana Bash called a number of other people who were mentioned in the report as the president is, and ask them if they were shown a copy of the report. And in every single case, they were not shown a copy of the report. So the president was given special president's personal lawyers were given treatment that other people mentioned in the report were not.
You know, speaking of redactions, you were looking at the report earlier, saw considerable sections of it redacted.
On some, I mean, some pages are 100% unredacted, but there's a lot. There are a lot of redactions.
There's a New York Times story now breaking about what's underneath Barr's redactions, and they are comparing what's Barr's first name?
William.
William Barr, thank you.
Oh, I'm thinking of Bob Barr, sorry.
To Rosemary Woods, who was the secretary of Richard Nixon, who erased the 18-and-a-half-minute tape that covered up President Nixon's crimes, and they're talking about how there are people, apparently like K.T. McFarlane, that refused to carry out, or Don McCain, who refused to carry out orders of the president that he thought were incorrect or may get them in legal trouble. There were others who were willing to put themselves in legal jeopardy to cover up the president's crime, and of course people remember Rosemary Woods. So we don't know where the attorney general is on this. But
also among the redactions, there's a category that's sort of what he considers, what Barr as an individual considers to be these peripheral third-party folks whose reputations might suffer.
Yeah.
I mean,
is
no one
Don
has
Jr.?
Peeled back that onion.
I don't know.
I expect that
Jared?
Is a universe of people who are already significantly inculpated.
Ivanka?
By what is known publicly.
Well, let me give you another piece of good news, I think, on this front. And this one, it's impossible for Barr to be cooking because members of Congress would say he was cooking. When he was asked about what he – I don't know if he was asked. When he offered that he would be giving a copy to certain key legislators on Capitol Hill on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, the unredacted version, he said the only redacted – there are four categories of redactions, as I think people have all learned: intelligence matters, interfering with investigations, a grand jury testimony, and I at the moment forget what the fourth is just for a second. But he said that the only redactions that would remain in place when this report was given to key congressional figures were the redactions relating to grand jury testimony, because he says that's statutorily mandated on his part. He can't release that to them. And if that is cooked, as you suggest, some of the things he has said, Andrew Carball, classified data, you know, sources and methods are the fourth thing. If that's cooked, obviously they're going to scream foul and say, we didn't get any redactions. We didn't get redacted portions for reasons other than grand jury testimony. So I'm assuming he is telling the truth there. And if federal law does say that you can't give Congress redacted, you can't give Congress grand jury testimony, then frankly, he's giving them, it appears, all that they're entitled to. Would you not agree with that?
Except that with regard to the grand jury testimony,
he has
the direct authority to go before the court, as others have done before him, to get
that's a good point.
And he his answer when he was asked in Congress was he refused to say, to outright deny that he would do it. He simply said, "Well, if the chair of the Judiciary Committee wants to do it, he can go and do it." It's just an utter abdication, I think, of his role.
And the other thing is,
and protecting Trump again,
was just pointed out in a story I just read that based on its pattern of dishonest conduct in office, the Trump administration cannot be trusted to be honest with the nation about what parts of the report need to be remained concealed from public
view.
And that's a very good issue too. I mean, it's hard, why should anyone trust the Attorney General to make that very subjective decision?
Can we recap where we are? By the way, if people just woke up from a long sleep, at about 9:33 this morning, William Barr held his press conference describing some of the findings. Some are suggesting it was essentially the second letter to the American people on the part of Barr. No one other than the president's personal and his White House lawyers had seen the redacted version, obviously, other than people on the Mueller team and the Justice Department team. He spoke about it for about 20 minutes, took some questions. Two of the questions he did not answer were political questions about whether or not you're essentially here operating as the president's lawyer. One of the questioners mentioned you use the word spying in front of Congress, and the president then went on to fundraise on your own language. He avoided those two questions. Shortly after 11 o'clock, copies of the redacted version were given to members of Congress, and virtually seconds after that, the report itself was published on the Department of Justice website. And if you're wondering why our analysis is piecemeal, is because virtually everybody in America, from highly competent reporters at places like the Washington Post and the New York Times are going through it, dividing it up, going through it page by page. And we're attempting to do the same thing as our colleagues are doing. So we're giving it to you as best we can, as fast as we become aware of portions.
But wait a minute. Beyond all of this, beyond the, as we go through, you know, the report, you know, line by line, paragraph by paragraph, I just want to reflect for a moment on how low the bar is that we are in the face of what legitimately, objectively has to be described as overwhelming evidence of misconduct by this president with regard to the underlying issues for the investigation. And keep in mind, Mueller's you know, scope was widened in terms of the ancillary things that he could take a look at. But in terms of the collusion, it is a very narrow definition. It almost has to be a conspiracy by direct agreement.
Had to sit down and agree together.
Right.
Between
the Russian government.
Russians and Trump
and a nominee for a president of the United States.
So
it's very, very narrow.
It's probably
right?
has to be like a contract.
Exactly. So I'm just pointing out how low the bar is when people have had in front of them almost on a daily basis through tweets, through interviews that he has given, through his statements, you know, at the White House, an enormous amount of evidence of this, of his mens rea, of his specific intent to obstruct this investigation, this inexplicable defense at all turns of Putin to the exclusion of his own intelligence agencies. All of the things that he has been unwilling to say or do or admit in terms of the way Russia tried to hijack this election, I'm just floored that we are because we have to, I guess, piecemealing or parsing the words in Mueller's report when the evidence of the crime, I think, or the misconduct, the impeachable, eminently impeachable misconduct, has been in front of us every single day for nearly 2 years. And I think every time we go further afield in trying to sort of drill down, I mean, essentially the Attorney General is saying, well, if he didn't commit, we're finding that he didn't commit a crime. So, you know, that should be good enough for all of you.
Well, but that is good enough for prosecutors. He is not the United States Congress. He can't say it doesn't rise to the level of criminality, but it does, in my opinion, rise to the level of being an impeachable offense.
No,
that's not his business,
I understand
right?
that. No. I understand that. What I'm saying is that Barr is the Attorney General of the United States. His prosecutors every day march into court on a fraction of the evidence that is before him in Mueller's report and send people to jail for decades and decades and decades. And the bar that we have with Trump, it's always lowering the bar. And I think the damage that he has done to the presidency is incalculable as a result of that. That we should be looking at. I mean, the founders, when you look back at what the founders felt about impeachment, why they framed the necessity of impeachment the way they did, it had to do with the morality of the president. It had to do with the president's willingness to put country before himself. Just on that basis alone, Trump fails on all cylinders all the time.
Well, then theoretically, your fellow Democrats, and you're a good Democrat, would say, I assume, if they feel as strongly as you do, is that even if no crime was committed, according to Mueller, and even if we don't have Republican votes for conviction, we have an obligation
that's
under
exactly
the Constitution
what they should
to impeach
be doing.
Him. Well, Nancy Pelosi
I know,
is
but
taking
I,
a very different position.
Here's the question about that, though. And I think Pelosi raises a great point about this. We are so divided. I mean, we get emails, we're getting them right now, about people saying this is continuing to be a witch hunt. No crime, no crime, no collusion, no collusion. With the country so divided, aren't we better, for the sake of the United States, to not have impeachment hearings, which the Republicans, unless they suddenly develop a spine, which they haven't in 2 years, put their country ahead of their party and their allegiance to this presidency, to vote him out of office? I mean, isn't that
no.
a more salutary end?
No. Okay. No. In my opinion, no. There is a reason that impeachment is an option. And it has to do with what you will and will not tolerate in terms of the behavior of your president and how damaging that behavior is to the country. I mean, beyond what's in the Mueller report, there is so much more that he has been. There are emoluments issues. There are personally profiting off the presidency, lying about a blind trust. I mean, the fact that foreign governments can curry favor with us by simply showing up here and booking rooms in the Trump Hotel. come on. I mean, how low can you go? Yeah.
I mean, Bill Clinton, it looks like Michael the Archangel. You're thinking about it now compared to this. He lied about Monica Lewinsky. Impeached.
Andrea, it's good to see you. Okay. It was a relaxed conversation.
We never get to any of our other stories. By the way,
it's a pretty big story.
Apparently,
today,
the special counsel found evidence of plenty of other crimes, only two of which, they made 14 referrals. Only two of these crimes they even know about. One involving Michael Cohen, the other involving the former Obama lawyer, Gregory Craig. There's 12 others, Jim. Mystery crimes.
Good to see you, Andrea. Thank you so much for your time.
Andrea Cabral joins us every week for Law and Order. We didn't get to our other stories, but we did talk about the Mueller investigation. We're going to keep talking about the Mueller investigation with legal analyst and former Mueller colleague, that is, Michael Zeldin. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For the last couple of weeks, Michael Zeldin has been preparing us for the Mueller report. Along the way, he predicted a showdown between Congress and the president over the full report, gave us insight into Mueller's process, and pointed out the defects of the special counsel law. Now that the moment has arrived, he joins us after a whopping 90 minutes of analysis. It came out roughly 11 o'clock. Michael, as you know, is a former colleague of Robert Mueller, a legal analyst for CNN and a resident fellow at the Institute of Politics at the Harvard Kennedy School. Michael, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Before you start, Michael, let me just say we're getting a ton of emails about what's the Democratic reaction going to be. At exactly 1 o'clock, Jim McGovern, who I think most of you know is the chair of the House Rules Committee, will join us to give us the response, or at least the reaction, of the Democratic leadership in the House of Representatives. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
So this is a day that the speed readers are all very grateful they took those speed reading courses. I know that it's massive. You haven't gotten, I'm sure, a chance to go through it all. But what's your takeaway, Michael Zeldin, for as far as you've gotten?
Well, there are a lot of things to be taken away from this. Fundamentally, it's so interesting to me to see just how many contacts there were between the Trump campaign and surrogates of the Trump campaign and Russians who were endeavoring to hurt the Clinton campaign and, you know, indirectly help the Trump campaign. And yet at no time were any of these individuals who were contacted by the Russians ever to take the step of contacting law enforcement. And so I find just that it may well be that the actions that they undertook were not criminal, but they sure were, you know, sort of unethical in some sense. In the sense that if you're running a campaign, you take the June 9th meeting at Trump Tower. What they said there was the reason we're not going to charge criminal conduct there was we can't prove, essentially, that Don Jr. knew enough to know that this was illegal, and therefore we can't charge him criminally. But Don Jr. should have known it was wrong. And there are a lot of other things like that in the report where there was just activity that was wrong and should have brought anyone to conclude that they should have contacted law enforcement. So that's my sort of overarching impression of this thing?
My overarching impression, and I haven't gotten nearly as far as you, but just what I've read so far about some of the obstruction and Trump staffers keeping him from doing things that may have been illegal because they wouldn't carry out his orders, is it, to put it in a football analogy, it's like we came up to the 45-yard line on collusion and obstruction but didn't cross the 50-yard line. That's what a lot of this sounds like to me, that there were a lot of bad things went on, but they didn't rise to a level of a crime.
Well, that was Mueller's mandate, to determine whether or not this activity was criminal. He wasn't there to make moral judgment, as I just did. I have concluded that what occurred here was wrong and unacceptable. But Mueller had a different standard, which was this criminal? And what he said was, there are lots of things here, the firing of Comey, the request by the president to get rid of Flynn, the lying about the June 9th meeting on Air Force One, all of these things. He said these things are problematic, but for technical legal reasons, I cannot charge them criminally. So he did his job, and then we are left with the, you know, sort of the follow-up conclusion to say, well, what do we think about this president and his administration and the way they conducted themselves throughout the course of this inquiry? And that's a political determination, not a legal one.
I want to go back to the legal, though. You say not technically meeting the legal threshold for criminality. And apparently the missing ingredient from what we read so far is a clear criminal intent. And we've already discussed, I'd like your thoughts in a minute, about the decision apparently by Mueller not to subpoena the president for fear that it was going to delay this whole thing. But you just listed a couple of things that bear repeating, that Donald Trump apparently told the Hope Hicks and others, his communications person at the time, not to tell the public the truth about the meeting at Trump Tower. This is at a meeting in which she said the story is going to be massive, the emails are really bad. He calls Don McGahn at home, his counsel, to say yet again, fire Mueller. He won't. He calls Jeff Sessions, the then attorney general at home, saying, please, not please, you should unrecuse yourself. He doesn't. He allegedly fires Comey because Comey won't publicly say that he didn't do anything wrong. What I don't understand, we were discussing with Sandra Cabral a little bit, why can't criminal intent be inferred by the actions themselves? Just take one for a second. Why would he say to lie about, in June or July of 2017, a year after the meeting, to not tell the truth about the Trump Tower meeting? What other possible intent could there be to obstruct justice? I just don't understand that at all. What am I missing?
Well, you can conclude that, and it wouldn't be unreasonable and different.
That there was intent based on the acts.
Well, what Mueller said in the report was that in respect of that June 9th meeting, for example, was that the cover-up of it, which could be used circumstantially to prove knowledge of its being wrong at the outset, occurred almost a year later and could have political motives behind it, not just legal motives. And because of that dual motive, it's hard for a prosecutor to go into a court and say the reason he lied was because he knew at the outset that this was criminal, and now he's covering up that criminal event.
But the political motive, Michael, I don't mean to be argumentative, but just to understand this, the political motive is self-protection. And so how is that – where's the dividing line between the political motive of self-protection and the criminal motive to self-protect – so as not to be found guilty of obstructing justice? Don't they sort of leak into each other?
They can, and they did in the case of Bill Clinton. Remember, yeah, his yeah. defense was, I was lying to cover up an affair that was embarrassing to me and my family. Donald Trump has said the same thing with respect to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal's, the women who have alleged inappropriate sexual relations. And he has said, I did not lie to influence the outcome of the campaign. Rather, I did so to protect my marriage. So these are the types of evidentiary bits that prosecutors have to evaluate and then exercise their prosecutorial discretion with respect to. And in this case, and I said on the show long ago that in many respects, Trump was very lucky to have Bob Mueller as his prosecutor because he had the sort of intestinal fortitude to say that something wasn't criminal if he thought it wasn't criminal. Whereas many people, I think, could look at the same evidence here that we're discussing now and say, you know what, all these things taken together do evidence criminal state of mind and criminal intent, and therefore I'm going to charge them with it. Mueller, you know, being an institutionalist and a conservative, elected otherwise.
You know, we asked you before about the president's intent being unclear, that he did answer questions by writing. Apparently, Mueller considered those answers to the questions inadequate, but he didn't push getting an interview with the president. And tell people again what your theory is about why Mueller did not push for that interview, because it makes you think now maybe that was a mistake. I don't know.
Well, Mueller addresses this in the report. And what he says in the report is that when it came right down to it, it was going to do two things. One, it was going to delay the prosecution at this late stage of the investigation. And that two, he thought that more or less he had the evidence that he needed. And so I think Mueller made essentially a political judgment that I don't want this to be delayed any longer. I mostly have what I need, and I do not want to invoke a constitutional crisis along the lines of Richard Nixon firing Archibald Cox and setting up that whole impeachment process. So I think Mueller, you know, sort of stood up and said, it's not worth the collateral damage for my asking for this when more or less I have what I need, and I'll just move forward.
But when you say, Mike, I'll have what I need, let me read you verbatim. I'm unable to conclude that no criminal conduct occurred. It seems to me, in those words, he's saying, I don't have enough information to draw, well, he says it literally, unable to conclude that no criminal conduct occurred, a double negative, which we're not supposed to use, of course. Doesn't that cry out for, well, I need more information to be able to make a conclusion? And I have chosen, for the reasons you mentioned, and he affirms those reasons in the report itself, I'm not going to go ahead with the one thing that will probably allow me to come to a conclusion one way or another.
Maybe. However, if you think of yourself as a criminal defense lawyer and you have a prosecutor who's asking you as the defense lawyer to provide your client to the prosecutor, for the prosecutor to ask your client whether or not the client acted with an intent that will likely get him indicted, you as a criminal defense lawyer would say, absolutely not. And maybe he asserts the Fifth Amendment, but he is certainly not going to go in voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And so in this same situation where he is saying, I want this information, Marty and Jane Raskin, the lawyers for the president, said, absolutely not. We're not doing that. If you want to subpoena him and go through the constitutional fight and you think you can meet the standards that the Supreme Court has set for having a need for this evidence and no alternative means of getting it, fine, let's have that fight. But we are not bringing our client in so that you can confirm his criminal state of mind. It's just not going to happen. And then they decided not to proceed.
You know, he also said this morning, Barr, when he disclosed that he sent a redacted version of the Mueller report to the president's legal counsel, which I assume is not, well, I mean, the whole thing is pretty unusual, but that doesn't cross a line. He also said that it was not crossing a line, these aren't his words, these are mine, to have sent a redacted version of the report to his personal counsel. I mentioned just before you got here, the issue was raised on CNN, your station, this morning. Well, if that's an appropriate act, personal counsel, not the White House counsel, if that's an appropriate act for one person focused on in the report, Donald Trump, then one would assume that it would be an appropriate behavior on the action on the part of William Barr for everybody mentioned in a big way in the report. And Dana Bash did some random calling to other people who were major players in the Mueller report, and none of them had had the redacted version offered to them or shared with them. Is it kosher for Barr to have shared the redacted version, again, with his personal, Trump's personal lawyers, not with the White House lawyers, is it?
I don't think it was. What Barr said was that under the Ethics in Government Act, He is sharing with private counsel this report as is contemplated by that act. Of course, that's the independent counsel statute, which no longer is in effect.
And as you've mentioned many times, and though,
in,
yes.
That's right. In the article that I wrote about it, which we discussed on air, I said, bring back the independent counsel statute so that those reports can be made available to people who are named in it and have a chance to comment on it. Barr has presumably resurrected that act from the dead and decided the only persons who will receive it are his private counsel. I don't think that was right. And I think it creates a bad impression that Barr is acting as a political actor here. And I think it was unfortunate for him to have done that.
We're talking to Michael Zeldin. He's at the Kennedy School. He's on CNN, former special assistant to Robert Mueller.
Well, it struck many people. We were watching the Attorney General Barr this morning at his pre-release of the Mueller report press conference, and he repeatedly said that there was no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. He seemed to be acting as a political actor this morning in a way that I thought was unusual. But perhaps, I mean, he did seem to be, as a couple of commentators remarked, almost looking to be the defense lawyer for the president.
I think that it was ill-considered for Barr to have done two things. First was to write that letter on March 24th, which outlined what he called the principal conclusions of the Mueller report. I don't think that he should have summarized that. The 73 words of this 400-page report that he sent to Congress, I thought was ill-considered. Secondly, I think that the press conference was ill-considered. What those two acts do for me is to show that the Justice Department essentially has taken over this case. The whole reason that you have a special counsel is to prevent the Justice Department from taking over the case of the independent counsel who is supposed to be independent. And so in this case, Mueller made his findings about collusion, didn't reach a conclusion about obstruction, but said it's a close call and that Congress should look at it under their standard of review, which is a different standard of review with political high crimes and misdemeanors. And Barr at the press conference today said, well, you know what? We're going to just take it over and end this. And I find no obstruction. Mueller found no collusion. Here's my press statement saying essentially the case is over. That's my prerogative as Attorney General. I just think that maybe he should have thought about the appearance that he has now as a political appointee sort of usurped the role that should have been exclusively left for Mueller. It should have been Mueller who was having a press conference today to outline his report if Mueller chose to do that. It should not have been Barr speaking to the report, which is Mueller's, because now it is essentially the Justice Department's report. And I don't think that that was what was contemplated in the establishment of the independent counsel statute or in the special counsel regulation.
So he wasn't there today. One of the questions after the statement made by the Attorney General was, and I don't have it verbatim in front of me, do you have any objection to Mueller testifying in front of Congress? And Congress has already, the House Democrats have already said they want him, I think by May 23rd. I can't remember. I think it was May 23rd. And he said, I have no objection. Is it likely that we will hear from Bob Mueller? I mean, you know him personally. We've talked to you a lot about how I'm reading into what you've said in the past, but he often likes his work to speak for himself. But if Congress formally requests his presence and his, I wouldn't say his boss, but I guess his boss when he was doing this, the Department of Justice, through William Barr, said, no problem on my part to have him there. Will we see him?
I think we will see him. I think that it was a good answer to the question by Barr that Mueller will be allowed to testify. What he will testify to remains to be heard. It will be interesting to see whether Mueller, because he will be asked, does he take issue with any of the ways in which the Attorney General characterized his report and superseded the Attorney General's judgment for Mueller? I think there'll be a lot of conversation about that, but I think Mueller will come forward and testify. I just don't expect Mueller to say anything grossly sort of oppositional to what Barr said in this press conference today, because that's not Mueller's character.
You know, on an note for about 30 seconds here, since everybody's angry about something or disappointed about something in the report with Barr, whatever, I guess Donald Trump is not upset with what William Barr had to say. You know what's amazing?
What's amazing?
That to our knowledge, there was never a leak from the Mueller team by the Mueller team. Would you have thought we would have gotten to 11 o'clock this morning? What was it, 3 weeks ago that the 3+ weeks ago the report was delivered to the Attorney General? We go 3+ weeks without a leak from the Department of Justice of the report. This has basically been a leak-free investigation and a leak-free month, which I think is actually a pretty good thing. We're talking to Michael Zeldin.
You know, let's talk big picture here for a little bit. So, you know, overall, and again, I know this is just fresh off the presses, as it were, there's a lot of shenanigans, it looks like to me, that went on. And I'm trying to get, how big a deal is this, is what I'm asking you, I guess.
Well, in political terms, this thing will have legs. There is enough in this report that reflects a willingness on behalf of the Trump campaign to coordinate with or be receptive to efforts by the Trump, by the Russians to assist their campaign, whether it be in hurting Hillary Clinton directly with the release of emails, whether it's helping Bernie Sanders, which hurts Hillary. There's a lot of stuff here that is just politically objectionable. Again, Mueller has said, I don't find a criminal basis to proceed here, but I think that there's going to be a lot of conversation about the manner in which the Trump campaign conducted itself. For example, there's one thing that struck me as interesting. Barr said in his press conference today that the coordination between the Trump campaign, whether it be Roger Stone or Don Jr., and WikiLeaks is not actionable because the WikiLeaks organization has essentially a First Amendment right to publish, and that absent evidence that you affirmatively participated in the hacking itself, you can't be charged with publication illegally. When you'll read what they did there, which was coordinate with WikiLeaks through emails and otherwise in order to obtain information about when the leaks were going to be released to the public and how they were going to be released and how could they be done in the most damaging way. And then you juxtapose that against the indictment that they just brought against Julian Assange for essentially doing the same thing, unsuccessful effort to look at a passcode that Chelsea Manning gave to him that would have allowed Chelsea Manning to tap into a computer under a fictitious name. They decided that that was a criminal conspiracy to violate the computer hacking laws. In this case, they stepped back from that, saying it's just not quite there. I don't like that. I didn't like that part of it one whit. I would have thought that
these things— Because you're saying two different conclusions for essentially the same action.
For very similar actions, yeah. in my mind. People will disagree. They'll say that when Assange offered to help Manning look at this password, that was the difference. I just don't see it as being so substantial that one results in an indictment 7 years after the fact of the acts, and this one you get a conclusion that, well, without there being active hacking, there's no such criminal liability.
Yeah, he did make a point. I forget now if it was where I read it, if I read it in the report or if I read it in an analysis of the report, but that's why they concluded in the report that even had the Russian campaign colluded with WikiLeaks to get this information out, that wouldn't be collusion because it wasn't a crime to disseminate that information. Is that seems like essentially
right.
What they're saying?
Dissemination alone. You got to hack and disseminate right. Was essentially his point.
Right. So what you got here, which is why I say there's so much.
You get a wide berth, I guess, from Mueller.
Exactly. Well, what you get here, which I said, you know, I don't usually make political comments. I'm not trying to make it as a political comment. But what strikes you as wrong is the Russians are hacking into the DNC, Democratic National Committee, and John Podesta, the chairman of the Hillary campaign, emails. They are giving it to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is going to disseminate it in a way that is hurtful to the Clinton campaign and helpful to the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign knows this is going on and is encouraging it. The president, I think, 140-something times on the campaign trail says, I love WikiLeaks. He said dishonest media for not following up on the story of WikiLeaks' releases. That's an encouragement of, you know, continuing what was a crime. Mueller says, though, unless they participated in the hacking itself, it's not criminal. But it's got to be wrong. I mean, you just can't accept that behavior as normal or acceptable for a presidential campaign, irrespective of whether they understand that, technically speaking, this may violate the campaign finance laws. It's just not right.
Yeah, I wonder if you have anything about the timing of that WikiLeaks stuff, because we all recall that the tape came out about the president admitting that he liked to grab women by the whatever, and then remember the WikiLeaks things came out shortly thereafter.
Same afternoon, yeah.
I wonder if there was any, how that came to pass. Will we get to the bottom of that? I don't see any reference of that so far. Anyway, Michael Sullivan.
Michael, thank you hugely.
Thank you very, very much for taking the time to come in on a very, very busy day. Michael Zeldin is a former colleague of Robert Mueller. He's a legal analyst for CNN and a resident fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School. He joins us regularly. Thanks again, Michael. Coming up, Congressman Jim McGovern joins us for his take on the Mueller report. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Almost out of breath kind of a thing. Everybody is reading, or a lot of people are reading as fast as they can. Michael Zeldin has major news outlets around the country, and it's obviously coming out in dribs and drabs, and we'll continue to give it to you as the day goes ahead. But first, when William Barr released his synopsis of the Mueller report, I think it was March 24th, Congressman Jim McGovern tweeted the following: shouldn't be a surprise that the president's own handpicked attorney general doesn't think he obstructed justice. He's entitled to his own opinion, but Congress must see the full unedited report to decide whether or not the president abused his power. Well, the lightly redacted report is out. So now what? Congressman Jim McGovern joins us in line. He's a Democrat representing the state's 2nd District, and of course he is chair of the House Rules Committee. Congressman, thanks so much for your time.
Happy to be with you.
Well, Congressman, I don't know if you're a speed reader or if anybody on your staff is a speed reader, but from what you know now, what's your reaction to the Mueller report?
Yeah, well, let me just say, I think this is a sad day for the presidency, and it's a sad day for our nation. And, you know, I think it comes down to whether you think Russia interfering with our election and the Trump team welcoming and rewarding their help is wrong. The president might not think what his team did was wrong, but I do. And I, as far as the attorney general goes, I mean, he came off, from what I was able to witness this morning, he came off like Rudy Giuliani. He sounded like the president's personal attorney trying to spin this rather than be straightforward with the American people about what was in this report. And what is in this report is disturbing. I don't care whether you like Trump or don't like Trump. You know, no president should behave in a way where he feels he's not accountable to anybody, or that he thinks he's above the law. That, I mean, he sounds like a dictator in this Mueller report. Is somebody who believes that you know, he can order people to essentially twist the truth and lie and get away with it? And I just find this all so disturbing. I mean, as somebody who respects the institutions of government, this president has diminished the presidency, and I think it's a sad day for our country.
You know, I just read a tweet from you, Congressman, talking about Congress must see the full unedited report. Barr, at his press conference this morning, said a copy of the report will go to certain leaders in both parties in Congress, intelligence chairs, etc. And the only redactions, he listed 4 areas of redaction, the only redactions that will remain in place that which is can't be released because it's grand jury testimony. Will that, and assuming he complies with what he said he was going to do, will that satisfy you and your colleagues? You get the whole kettle of fish with the exception of that which is grand jury testimony. Is that enough?
Yeah, well, so here's the problem. Based on the way this attorney general has acted, I don't trust him. I mean, I don't think he is interested in making sure we get to the whole truth. And we'll see what he releases, to the relevant committees. I mean, I'm looking at portions of the report. I'm looking at page 18 of the report. Everything is blacked out on page 18. There are other pages in the report the same way. I'm not sure what that is, but I'm not going to take the attorney general's word on his face. His initial response, which was that four-page memo that he released to the Congress and to the public, I mean, that paints a very, very different picture of the Mueller report than what we are seeing with what was released today. I mean, a dramatically different picture. And I think that this report really is a damning indictment of the entire Trump presidency. I've long been concerned about this culture of corruption and criminality, that exists in this White House. And I think this report exposes it. And, this is a president who promised to drain the swamp, and he created a cesspool in Washington. And as the American people read what has been, released, it'll become clear.
You used the terms in the last 30 seconds, Congressman, damning indictment, culture of corruption. So the Democrats now control the House of Representatives. What do you and your colleagues do about it? We all know that Nancy Pelosi has said in the last couple of weeks, the Speaker, impeachment is off the table. I was actually surprised to hear the number three Democrat in the House, Jim Clyburn from South Carolina, on CNN last night, actually talking about impeachment, not saying you would do it, but including it in this conversation in a very different way from how I think Speaker Pelosi has. What do you do if there is a culture of corruption? What if you do if your colleagues agree that it is a damning indictment, the report? What's the Democrats' move?
Well, we can't just turn the other cheek and make believe that none of this is happening. And I personally believe that nothing is off the table. Clearly, Mueller intended Congress to take a look at the damning new information in this report and decide whether it rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's a discussion that we're going to have. I mean, I think one of the things that the Attorney General did intentionally is release this report when we're all off for Easter, and Passover break. And so we're not in this week. We're not in next week. But I think as soon as we get back and we're all together, that will have given us all enough time to have gone through all the 400 pages. Hopefully the unredacted versions will have gone to the relevant committees, or they will have had a chance to go through all of that, and then we're going to have a serious discussion about what we do next. But this is not normal behavior by any executive, and this is something that should concern everybody. I don't care whether you agree with Trump's policies or not. This really is an affront to the American people, and we know that the Trump campaign, based on this report, directly attempted to find the leaked emails that Russia eventually leaked. So when people say there's no collusion, I don't know what the hell you would call that. Maybe people will be satisfied believing that the Trump team were just useful idiots for the Russians, and would just take anything that they got. But this is really disturbing. I mean, Russia, a foreign power, attacked our democracy. They tried to influence our election. I think they did. And the lack of concern by this president to get to the bottom of it, and his attempts to kind of cover up all the ties that his team had with the Russians, I just think is unconscionable.
When you said Jim McGovern a second ago, they attempted to interfere in our election, affect our election, and I think they did. Is the end of that sentence that you think that Donald Trump wouldn't be president were it not for the Russian interference?
I personally do. I've seen the classified and the unclassified reports about Russians' interference in our election. And, if this election came down to 70,000 votes in three states, and we know that there was an attempt by the Russians to focus in on the Midwest, I don't think it's an unreasonable conclusion. Others may differ with me, but that's just my personal opinion.
I know the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said before this was days ago, that she wasn't keen on impeachment. But you think to yourself, as just a regular citizen, okay, Bill Clinton lied under oath about sex with Monica Lewinsky, and impeachment proceedings began. Didn't ultimately prevail.
He was impeached. He just wasn't convicted
exactly.
and removed.
Exactly. By the Senate. He was not convicted and removed, but the proceedings began. It almost seems, how can Congress justify going after Clinton and then not go after Trump? I don't, you know what I mean?
Well, as I said before, I mean, there's a lot of serious conversation that needs to happen when Congress gets back into session. And I think in the immediate period, I think it is important for people, and myself included, to get through all the 400 pages. And it is important for the American people to be able to digest what is in all these 400 pages. This is not what the Attorney General said it was when he released his 4-page memo. This is not a complete exoneration of the president and his team. This raises a lot of serious issues, and I think Congress is going to have to figure out how to deal with it. These are hard conversations, but this is serious stuff. And I'm going through this, and I keep on reminding myself that this is the United States of America, you know, that this is a president of the United States who is behaving this way. And it really is sad that, this is where we're at, and that we have somebody in the White House who not only lies, but he's a pathological liar and who believes he's accountable to nobody. And the report says that, what makes it, difficult to decide whether any of these issues raise to the level of criminality where the president could be indicted. Although they do, Mueller does say that the Justice Department's policy of not indicting a sitting president was considered, in some of their conclusions. But when you read this report, they say what prevented the president from doing even worse things was the fact that his staff refused to carry out his orders. I mean, this is where we're at right now, and I think it's terribly, terribly disturbing.
Congressman, thank you very much.
We really appreciate your time.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. We'll talk soon.
Yes, we will. Thank you so much. Congressman Jim McGovern is chairman of the House Rules Committee. He's a Democrat representing the state's 2nd District.
Can I just say,
we have a lot of emails, people that nonetheless are with the president on this.
Can we read some of those when we get back, if we can?
Sure.
So we'll do that. But before we do, Jim McGovern is the chair of the Rules Committee, which is one of the most senior positions of the House of Representatives. And he said two things. He said a number of things that I think bear mentioning. One, that despite what Nancy Pelosi did say about impeachment, he said, quote, nothing is off the table, which I think is a big deal. Again, he is part of the leadership team. And Jim McGovern, and very few Democrats, a lot of Democrats, understandably and correctly, and I wish Republicans would talk about Russian interference because it undermines our democracy. His view is that Hillary Clinton would be president of the United States had it not been for Russian interference. So it's not, at least in the mind of one senior congressperson, it's not an abstract notion that they tried to undermine our election, in his mind, they succeeded in undermining the election.
Well, one of the things that was there, that a lot of African Americans didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, and one of the reasons was it was this whole thing about her talking about these young guys that were running around in gangs and doing selling crack cocaine, so for the predator thing. I mean, she took that hurt her a lot. There was an undermining of her. And there was a fomenting of a lot of anti-immigrant animus through the Russians that I think really impacted the election. Hillary Clinton was not a strong candidate, I don't think, in anybody's mind, or certainly not in my mind. And you had a guy, as I've said a million times, that was promising to fix the healthcare problems and the immigrant problems
Drain
and the
swamp.
Wage problems of a lot of Americans. And he ran as a populist, and he's governed, of course, as Marie Antoinette. But that's how he ran. You can see why people voted for them. It didn't take much, I don't think, to push people over to that edge. People were disgusted with Washington, and you get that. And she was a product of Washington, and Donald Trump was not.
So I'm going to make a suggestion about how we proceed here,
what?
If it's okay. I think you and I could both use a break. So why don't we do this?
What are we going to do,
take
Jim?
A break. Come
go
back.
Out for lunch?
We'll have Alex Beam join us.
Have a cocktail.
So we have a little bit of a diversion. We'll get his take on this, too, but discuss a few things other than the Mueller report. And then at roughly 1:30, we will return. And for the final half hour of today's shows, we'll continue to take your calls until we are done at 2 about the Barr press conference at 9:30 and about the release of the report itself, though redacted to some degree, at 11 o'clock. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. Here with us in Studio 3 for a 20-minute break, because we need it, and then we'll return to Mueller for the rest of the show, is Alex Beam. And as we do every time Alex is here, we marvel that his name is Alex Beam, obviously, because when Alex writes, Alex de Tocqueville comes to mind, because we wonder, what has he been token? Alex, it is very nice. Thank you. I did that even in these circumstances, which were rather stressful. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Yes, and I'm really glad later, before you leave, you're going to tell us what happened to Julian Assange's cat, and I've been wondering a lot about that myself.
I've been getting email about it already.
Yeah, so we're going to get to the bottom of that quandary. Right. Are we going to talk at all about Mueller with Alex
Wouldn't you like to know his opinion?
What do you think, Alex?
I thought the whole point was we're going to kick back.
No, okay. For 30 seconds, maybe we're not going to kick back.
I want to associate myself with a remark I heard Marjorie make, but it was like an hour and 20 minutes ago.
What did I say?
I don't know. I think you said, and your guest objected, pushed back against you. But, I mean, this is going to have to be resolved at the ballot box in November of 2020.
That impeachment would be so divisive for the country.
The impeachment's not going to happen. And the next best hope.
Yeah, but can I make an analogy that is going to make both of you ridicule me no end, which I know will make both of you happy? Do you want to analogize the notion that we can't I don't know if he committed an impeachable offense. I'm not in Congress. But the notion that it can't be considered because it's far better to let the political process play out on the ballot is sort of analogous to what the Globe editorial said today. Is, hey, it's going to open in June. There are thousands of jobs. There's a lot of revenue. Wynn's got to open despite the fact that they've done some dirty deeds. At some point, again, I don't know where the truth lies. Well, I don't know what the right action is, but to not take action because of concern that at the end of the day, the Republicans in the Senate are going to vote no. If something is right, you do it. If something is wrong, you don't do it.
I mean, that's what I was saying to Ford McGovern. Okay, so you impeach Bill Clinton because he lied about sex under oath, and then you look at all these lists of all these terrible things and you do nothing. It kind of makes the institutions of
that was what I was trying to say. You said it better than I.
Jim should correct me on this. I quote-unquote researched the Clinton impeachment, which, you know, in my usual cursory way. It was actually a bipartisan Senate vote that voted not to eject him from office. It wasn't a party line vote.
No, but he wasn't ultimately convicted.
Right.
That's what he's saying. But it wasn't just Republicans.
So there's no reason to expect history not to repeat itself. I mean, this isn't the way a lot of people just aren't comfortable with this method of regime change. Jim, I was listening to every word you said.
You did?
It makes perfect sense. I mean, I guess if you're Nancy Pelosi, I think you have to play the medium game, not the long game, not the short game, but the medium game, and look to 2020, because that's offers some solace at this point.
We're talking to Alex Beam.
But I think you have to explain yourself and say, especially as we read this tonight, and maybe we've already seen the most damaging stuff. I don't know because I haven't finished it. But if it continues along these lines of detailing all these nefarious backroom shenanigans, I think you have to at least you just can't move past it, I don't think.
Well, you know what Pelosi's answer would be, I think, is we're not moving it past it, Marjorie. Well, we're not going to do impeachment, at least so she said. She said it's off the table by holding a series of hearings, Oversight Committee, Judiciary Committee, a whole variety of relevant committees in the House. We'll be letting the American people know what the truth is, and that will allow them, as you two are saying, to make an informed decision in 2020. So essentially, you know what I think they're proposing to do?
What?
Is have impeachment hearings without the I word, meaning we're going to do hearings but not consider impeachment of the
You may well be right, but that really opens them up to this barrage of tweets, you know, I mean, about from Trump whipping people up. I mean, even like people on the fence, you know, saying, look, they're just wasting the public's time. That they're on at this again, blah, blah, blah.
You know what's going to drive Marjorie Egan over the edge?
What?
I would say in January, Donald Trump is going to tweet the following. Hey, Americans, if I did such horrible things, why didn't the Democrats impeach me? They didn't impeach me because I didn't do anything wrong, because you sure as hell know if I did, that Nancy Pelosi would be breathing right down my neck. Mark my words, mark the tape, 119 on whatever day it is that's going
to
happen.
That speaks to an interesting issue, by the way, which is slightly separate, which is the deployment of epithets. I'm very into Trump's tweets, and I was amazed that he had sort of early deployment of his negative epithets for 2020, Sleepy Joe Biden, and what was it? Oh, Crazy Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. I thought he was going to hold those epithets until, say, maybe January of 2020.
He just can't control himself.
Okay,
are you ready to move on now?
We'll do 15 minutes of non-Mueller business. Okay. Sure.
You know, people, I think, were surprisingly verklempt over the fire at Notre Dame, and people got very emotional about it. And I think a lot of people were very excited to learn that these big millionaires from France were donating all this money toward the rebuilding of Notre Dame, until one of them tried to get a tax break. Off his donations. He was one of the guy that's with Kerrig, I guess, the millionaire from the Kerrig, you know, the Kerrig Foundation, said
environmental despoiler.
That's right. He said he wanted to get a big break on his taxes, and then the you know what hit the fan, because France has had this yellow vest protest about.
Why did you say kind of ununderstandably verklempt? Were you questioning the fact that people?
I guess I'm just speaking personally. I was more upset than I expected to be about that fire.
Oh, then I misheard you. I misheard. I think people were pretty verklempt, frankly.
Yeah, they were, which was interesting, I think.
What did you think?
The French who are notoriously
totally
a-religious or unreligious or whatever.
Totally
were out there singing hymns and blessing themselves.
Yeah, the needle moved from 11 to 12% in terms of church attending.
Exactly.
Well, except don't you think a huge percentage of that was history as much as it was religion? I mean, it's been there 850 years or something? I'm not a Catholic, and I was deeply touched by it, too.
Well, I think there is a religious thing to it, because I think people are hopeful and aspirational in general, and maybe you're not religious, but there's a kind of, you know, you hope for better angels kind of thing, but not really angels with wings.
But don't gloss over the inequality thing. There was celebration of the almost $1 billion that was raised, pledged almost immediately by business guys. And the point that was made in the New York Times, which is great, is ordinarily those kind of charitable deductions under the French tax code get a 60% deduction. Yeah. In this circumstance, they were entitled to a special 90% deduction. So essentially the taxpayers of France were subsidizing as much as 90% of the philanthropic moves of wealthy
Vuitton.
People over there. And ultimately, by the way, to the credit of the guy you mentioned, because of the huge blowback, he said, I'm not taking any tax deduction, including the 60% thing. But it is true, is France, Macron's been under a lot of pressure because he's not doing enough for low-income people. He eliminated the tax on the wealthy.
Yeah.
And there's a great celebration of the fact that people who were incredibly wealthy are willing to rebuild Notre Dame, but not help rebuild the lives of poor French workers. I think they have a wonderful point there.
I thought you were going to go in a different direction there, which is, I mean, the reverse outrage about how the Taliban has been desecrating, you know, Islamic shrines, et cetera.
Oh, well, that's...
I mean, shrines that belong to the Assyrians, et cetera. So, I mean, that's kind of, it is a true sort of weird white Judeo-Christian morning. I wanted to actually.
My response to that is, what is Aleppo? That's what I say. It's a Gary Johnson joke.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was missed in this room. Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay.
I want to, to change the subject.
Please do.
What about the. I mean, I apologize for laughing. I think we just lost like 4 listeners. But what about the crown of thorns? I mean, what is that about?
I don't know.
What, that whether it's a real deal or not, or that it was saved?
Yeah. I mean,
which?
Cue the eyeball roll. I mean,
2,000-year-old crown of thorns seemed a little bit.
Which was and they had two kind of échantillons, as the French would
Excuse
say.
Me?
They had two samples of it. They had one up in the rafters that fell down and somebody saved, and then they had the one that had been preserved. And
I'm always suspicious of the old Crown of Thorns story.
I'm always suspicious.
That it's not the real deal. You should explain for people.
I mean, there is a historical reverence of Jesus Christ being crucified. That's in the history books of the time. We know that happened. I just find it difficult. And that's whether you're religious or not religious. Josephus? He was the great historian of the day.
Yeah, 1 century A.D.
So we have this crucifixion thing. But the Crown of Thorns.
Crucifixion thing.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, you're going to go to.
Don't say it. I know where you're going.
Thank you. I won't say it.
Don't mention the Congresswoman.
Yeah. I mean, pieces of the True Cross. I mean, if you hang on Italy, there's enough pieces of the True Cross to sort of float. You know, the Queen Mary made of wood, basically.
And the Turin mask of Christ.
I had never heard that the Crown of Thorns was in Notre Dame, and I want to state for the record how happy I am that it was saved from the conflagration.
Can I go back to my point, which neither of you are interested in, just for 1 second?
Okay, I'll argue your point.
To show how painfully and irresolvably divided we are, one of the first things I thought about after the fire, as horrible as it was, and I was consumed by it too, I mean, horrible, is the only good out of this, it's going to bring people together at a time when people are not brought together by anything. That lasted about a nanosecond. As soon as these zillionaires started contributing, there started to be attacks on Macron. I happen to agree with the criticism. I know you don't. But there's almost nothing on which the people of the world can unite.
You're right and you're wrong.
How am I wrong?
I had a house guest over and the three of us, my wife and I mean, you know, that was the night of. It was impossible to take your eyes off the screen, right? Paris was burning, to juxtapose that ridiculous question. You're right. I mean, things move very quickly. The resentment and the negativity set in. But I thought for 18 to 24 hours it was of deeply saddening
and
moment.
I also think Macron may have been wrong about the wealth tax and there is growing income inequality. But on the other hand, Notre Dame Cathedral is for everybody. Everybody could go in there and be inspired by this incredible art. And we all remember, I got to go there a couple of times because both of my daughters were over for one of those years abroad deal. And you see that rose window and the height of the cathedral. I mean, it's just this magnificent thing. So it's like after 9/11, millions and millions of dollars were raised to go to victims' families from 9/11. You get murdered in Roxbury. No one's raising millions of dollars for you.
By the way, that issue was raised throughout the One Fund Boston, even though there was great...
I think these issues always come forward in these kinds of situations. But I think if somebody did something terrible, if the Washington Monument fell down tomorrow or...
Well, actually, that might be okay.
Well, maybe. Maybe. I don't know.
You know who's focused on that inequity, by the way, you'll find to be a strange human being.
Who
is cognizant of and troubled by the situation you just mentioned about who does get taken care of and who doesn't get taken care of in our society? Ken Feinberg, of all people. Ken Feinberg, I had him on TV a couple of weeks ago. He's the man who doles out the money after 9/11, after the Boston Marathon bombing.
I'm obsessed with him. Why was he on your show?
Because a film that was done about him, a documentary from 2017, was being shown that night at the Kennedy Library. It's a great documentary. I'll send it to you. But also, there is I think he told me this off air, that Michael Keaton is playing him in a film that is actually in the works. Could someone check that so I don't misrepresent?
He's a very interesting guy. Feinberg.
He's from Brockton, by the way.
Oh, that I didn't know.
He's from Brockton, and he was a key aide to Ted Kennedy, as I assume you do know.
I did not know, but I know he entered the history twice, of course, at 9/11, but he'd already been in history before that.
Agent Orange was his first major. He did the Agent Orange thing, and which obviously out of Vietnam, for those who didn't live through this and the damage that Agent Orange did. I'm right. There is a film actually coming out. He is a really interesting guy.
You know what I once asked him for? I read in a newspaper that a tiny percentage of the families had declined settlements from 9/11.
I think there were two. I think.
Oh no, said. No. There are many more.
No, I don't think. No.
I asked him for the list.
No. Neither did nothing. Neither settlements nor sued. That's what I was talking about. That's a very small number.
That was that woman, remember, he told us a story about going to visit the woman himself
on the subway.
And
he went
saying,
on the subway.
We're running out of time for you to put
file,
in your
please.
Claim.
Yeah.
And she didn't do it. Remember that story? Was it her son?
I think so. I think you were talking apples and oranges. You're talking about people who didn't seek relief of any kind. I'm talking about relief of neither kind, meaning no litigation or no partaking in the fund. You're just talking about not taking the fund, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, I have an email on the Crown of Thorns.
What's that?
Well, this is from Lynn, who says that Fox and Friends reported, apparently, that Mary Magdalene herself brought the Crown of Thorns to Paris.
Marguerite made a face.
Yeah,
which,
they did the state where it was stashed for the 1,200 years until Notre Dame was built.
Yeah, I mean,
I never heard of Mary Magdalene going to Paris.
Neither did I. But I went to a school that claimed to have an offshoot of the, Jesus Lord, what was it? Joseph of Arimathea brought the Glastonbury thorn. So Joseph of Arimathea was supposed to have gone to Britain. You know, with the thorn that was grown somewhere near where Christ died. This whole thing for the crown of thorns?
He's the one that gave the tomb to Christ. Joseph of Arimathea was the rich guy, and he said, let me take the body and bury him in the tomb.
Can I tell you a great idea I just came up with right on the spot?
What?
We should have Bob Mueller investigate the Mary Magdalene thing and then come to no conclusion.
Remember those Dan Brown books? That was the big theory, right? That Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene were married and had children.
Local
and that was also that Martin Scorsese film, The Last Temptation of Christ, right?
Yeah, the Knights Templar always.
Knights
everyone's
Templar.
Always wandering. I don't think people were quite as peripatetic at that time as they're being given credit for right now.
Yeah, it would be a long way to get from Jerusalem to Paris in those days.
Yeah. So before we get to the explainer that Marjorie is very interested in, Julian Assange's cat, the embassy cat, as it's called, and what happened to it, which Alex is going to explain,
cat.
Which I'm sure about three people are interested in. Was it in Japan that people are
lots
paying
people are
other people?
In the cat, Jim.
They are? Well, then
Tony's
going to talk about it.
They're very upset about the cat.
Was it Japan that we read that people are paying other people to drink bubble tea for them? And paying them? And theoretically, they are deriving the satisfaction without calories and those sort of things by just watching either streaming or video after the
360-degree video
of somebody drinking the tea
for
them.
We not only read this, I insisted that we discuss this because I'm going to get a whole column out of this.
I'm sure you are.
Yeah, because it's what I call intercessory eating. Is that you're getting someone to intercede in your own eating habits on your behalf. Anyway, it turns out everyone in Japan wants to drink bubble tea, especially young people, but they're super self-conscious about their weight. So basically you can pay someone roughly 50 cents in China to drink a large thing of bubble tea and consuming all the tapioca, which is quite fattening. There's
it's
a lot
fabulous.
Of sugar in bubble
tea.
That
was so good, little balls of tapioca.
Yeah, I know.
I love it.
And the texture is unbelievable. Yeah, and in any case, so... And it's a thing, obviously. It's like buying gold, I think, from Chinese miners for World of Warcraft, et cetera, et cetera.
No, but can I tell you something? Do you know what priming is? If you're writing a column, I should educate you a little bit.
It's a little late.
I did a commentary on this the other night. Is priming is the term that is used for example, there's some research, which I question, but some doesn't mean you couldn't include it. Some research that suggests that the mere smelling of coffee, which is one of the great smells in the world, could satisfy your need or urging for coffee. Priming is the term.
I haven't heard the term. That's totally understandable, right? Completely makes sense.
Well, it doesn't
frankly.
Make that much sense to me. I would argue, if anything, it creates a greater desire, not satisfies a desire. But there's some research that suggests.
No, because when I have a big sweet tooth, but I'm trying to lose weight, sometimes
just look at a piece of pie.
No, but if you take one spoonful of ice cream. And you think, and you kind of put all your zen on that spoonful. That'll be your dessert.
That should have been your explainer instead of this stupid embassy cat.
You're insane.
Okay,
listenership is going to spike, and the minute you go back to the Mueller report, boom. Okay.
We have to set the stage, though. He was with this cat for 7 years.
Julian Assange,
in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and they were basically two peas in a pod: Julian and the cat.
Okay, so here's the deal. Alex is going to allegedly explain what happened.
And we saw Julian marched out of there.
Oh, no, no, no. Don't give it away. Let him say.
And where was the cast?
Okay, fine. That's what he's going
to
say.
No, Marjorie's doing a great job.
No, she's not.
To know.
Yeah, she is
okay,
doing
you have 45
job.
Seconds.
No, no.
Looking this up. You have to look this up?
No.
You know, and here's another question.
Yeah.
Suppose it were Julian Assange's dog.
That's a good point.
People would be very upset
okay, fine.
About the dog.
Starting in 5 seconds, you have 45 seconds to explain what happened.
No, I think we have 4 or 5 minutes,
go ahead,
basically.
Take it away.
Exactly.
Well, Assange did have a cat with him in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And when Assange was forcibly removed, no cat. Huge question mark. The world wants to know.
Exactly.
Thank you. Apparently, the cat, in a sense, had been exfiltrated from the embassy a few months before and actually placed somewhere in London, maybe with relatives of Assange. But there's many more important details. First of all, did the cat have a name? No, the cat never had a name. It was called Embassy Cat, although it was sort of dubbed, quote, Catstro, because Julian Assange was so left-wing. How many Twitter followers did Embassy Cat have? Approximately, I think, 18 times as many as I have.
Wow.
Embassy Cat had 33,000.
33,000, Jim.
Twitter
followers. I think Castro Cat, is he being...
No. We're not done.
Sorry.
Because there's very much, a lot of more interesting stuff. So the Ecuadorians, as we know, had gotten sick of Assange and his crappy hygiene.
Because he didn't clean up after the cat.
I know, the cat litter, the kitty litter. In any case, there's this incredible quote in the Washington Post where an Ecuadorian diplomat is quoted as saying, quote, we're not running a pet store here. But there's two more things. It's been suggested, interestingly, that and this is why I had to get out the exact quote. Yeah. Julian stared at the cat for about half an hour. This is when he first saw the cat in the embassy saying, then he said, this could be useful. Let's say it's from my children. Everything is PR. I don't even think Assange has children. I have no idea. Wow. In other words, Assange saw the cat as a public relations tool that would get him more, you know, more attention around the world, more sympathy. The last thing I'm going to say is, unbelievably, the Washington Post asked a London-based veterinarian what's going to happen. And they're extremely worried that the cat might try to move from its new location back to Knightsbridge because both cats and dogs have incredible homing instincts.
They do.
And they're worried that they have trouble getting through traffic as it approaches the embassy.
Okay. I have a couple of questions about Castro.
Brief questions.
Was the cat forcibly taken from him, or did he, because of the hygiene issues, or did he decide it would be better to preemptively get the cat a good home?
It was extradited, from what I understand.
Okay. Exfiltrated was actually the term I used.
I was talking about extradition.
Okay.
Okay.
Exfilinated, basically.
Yes.
But I think he saw the cat as, I don't think he was that attached to the cat.
He wasn't attached to the cat.
And he saw it as a problem, and he saw an opportunity to get rid of it, and he did.
It was a PR move on his part to humanize him. That's all it was.
Exactly.
I mean, come on, get with it.
Okay, well, it's sad.
Nice to see you,
It's like the crown of thorns.
We just want the cat not to be traumatized by this change.
Yeah.
Our thoughts and prayers are with the cat.
Absolutely, they are with the cat. What's the cat's name, please?
Catstro.
No name? Embassy Cat?
Embassy Cat. Still on Twitter. Embassy Cat. 33,000 followers.
Is the cat ahead of you, Jim? Is the cat beating
you? He may not be.
Okay,
goodbye.
Okay.
Nice to see you, Alex.
Okay. Yep. Yes, you will. That was great. I'm so glad
What's that column you already finished? Can't wait for that.
Intercessory eating.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, speaking of columns, I should be promoting my own column. We never do it.
Oh, can I say
something? We never do it.
Let me say, because Marjorie Willem won't do this. I have been around you. You got more unsolicited praise from coworkers, from tweets, from whatever, for this brilliant column you talked. Hypocrisy on the Christian right is brilliant.
Yeah, it's fodder for the Easter fights.
It's great.
Donald
it's about Buttigieg,
Trump.
Right?
Buttigieg.
And
just fabulous.
Yeah. Buttigieg, yeah. It's in the Boston Globe today.
Globe
it's still there.
Today.
It's about
it
the hypocrisy of the Christian right.
Make sure you post the comment so the Globe can block the comment, which it had to do with a number of the comments.
I know.
On
I don't know
story.
What they're saying about me that could be that awful.
See, not about you, I don't think.
You don't think it's about me? You think it might be
you
about
see what happened
Buttigieg?
To
yeah,
Buttigieg?
They were yelling
these rallies.
Remember Sodom and Gomorrah.
Just disgusting.
Yeah, that's really nice.
And he handled it, by the way, with such cool. And
he did.
See, he's something. Bye, Alex. See you.
Okay, finally going. All right.
Thank you, Alex, very much. Alex Beam joins us every week. His latest book is Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, The End of a Beautiful Friendship. Coming up, we continue the Mueller conversation with you, unless Jim would like to talk more about the cat. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We'll spend the last, 20 minutes of the show talking with you about the Mueller report, about Barr's Attorney General Barr's presentation this morning at his press conference at 9:30. Any and all things Mueller. And again, we're fully aware of the fact that you, like we, have not had an opportunity to digest the whole thing. We read small portions of it. We read a lot of stories during breaks on it. But if you have any insight or any thoughts you'd like to share today, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in more depth again tomorrow, please give us a buzz. 877-301-8970. You said there were a lot of emails we got from people who were critical.
I've gotten so many about the Crown of Thorns that we just talked about.
Well, we're not going to do the Crown of Thorns.
No, I'm just saying it's
really
difficult
for me
to
find
the ones that I didn't keep track of.
So give us a buzz. 877-301-8970. A couple of things that are going to get lost in the shuffle, I think, are really important. Jim McGovern talked about Russian interference in the election, which we can add William Barr's name to those accepting it as a truth. Of course, the president does not. That won't get talked about much, and it's a very serious issue. Zeldin also made a really interesting point about contacts between Russians and Trump allies or aides, and even if they didn't rise to the level of crimes, why didn't they report those to authorities, which is the appropriate thing to do under the circumstances? Jim McGovern was with us, obviously one of the leading Democrats in Congress, saying nothing is off the table for him, despite what Nancy Pelosi has said about impeachment. And McGovern went so far as to say that he thinks Russian interference actually determined the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. That's a pretty big deal. One of the questions for me, and you and I fight about this almost every day, have the people had it? Meaning, is the attitude, I have Mueller fatigue, maybe not Barr fatigue, because we've only seen him a couple of times, I have Mueller fatigue, and regardless of what it says, regardless where I am, move on, deal with the health care mess in this country.
Here's one from Paul.
Okay.
Wow, today's show is laughable in its partisanships. I guess it's the Cambridge Brookline NPR access in the real world. No one cares. I'm working two jobs to pay the bills. I see a great many people every day and believe people are fed up with this.
What's that person's name?
Paul.
Hey, Paul, it sounds like you're busy today, but if there's any way when a line opens up, you could give us a buzz. 877-301-8970. I don't agree with the partisanship. I think we were calling it exactly as a sane person would see, particularly the Barr performance today. But we'd love to talk to you rather than just read your email,
Lisa,
but thanks for writing.
Says HRC, that's Hillary Rodham Clinton. The DNC rigged the nomination. Bernie Sanders would have beat Trump, not Hillary. Art says,
by the way, speaking of Hillary, there was a Conrad. It was a little thing on the screen of CNN while we were talking to Alex, saying the Russians tried to hack Hillary Clinton's emails within 5 hours. This is from the Mueller report, of Trump asking them to find her emails within 5 hours of Trump putting out the call.
Here's the problem, says Art. The Dems don't want the AG to be working for the president or the people. They want him to be working for the DNC. The next 24 hours is going to cement Trump's base, pull the forgotten ones he won in 2016 back into the fold and make inroads with a lot of others with a general distrust of big government. If the Dems don't cut it out and develop a message that's more than Trump is bad, Trump gets reelected with 5 or 6 more states in 2016.
By the way, your position, I think, is they've got to be able to walk and chew gum. That would be your response to that, is they've got to pursue this to where it leads, but at the same time, they have to figure out a way to move ahead on these other non-Mueller issues that actually matter to the American people,
too. You hear the candidates talking all the time about health care and talking about the economy. And so the candidates are doing it. Cable news at night is not doing it. But you look at the newspapers, and as I'm a big newspaper fan, they're talking about all these other things. So you can't just look at the primetime lineup of cable television. I mean, obviously today,
but laws don't change. They aren't changed by presidential candidates. They're changed by members of Congress. The question is, what do the House Democrats do, and what should they do?
They have put forth a lot of bills. They've put forth the bill on guns. They've put they're talking.
Well, they actually passed a couple in the House and sent them to the Senate.
Right, but they're not going to prevail in the Senate. But they have done things in the House. They made proposals on other things having to do with health care. But I don't know where they stand actually, in terms of how far they've gotten.
We'll get to your calls in 30 seconds. I may say something different tomorrow when I've read much more, so I reserve the right to have done that. I think the typical reaction from a decent, concerned American is going to be this, based on what we know so far. Admittedly, only 2 hours and 40 minutes after the report was released, and we haven't had an opportunity to sit down and actually read it, I knew most of these things. I now know more detail than I did before, and I feel exactly the same way I did before. Do you think anything you've heard or read today is going to change minds break this logjam in this country?
I think for Republicans that don't like this guy, I mean, his base is his base, but I think that for Republicans that don't like this guy, this combined with climate change that I mentioned before, that he is a total denier of.
They knew he was a denier yesterday. Too.
Right. They knew that. Well, they knew it in 2016. But as says, Jim, people didn't feel the same way about climate change
in 2016.
That's
a very good point.
As they do know. I think the issue of guns is going to be a bigger issue in this election. I think it's going to be a combination of things. I think that the cruelty of the president is, for me, it's a huge problem.
On the immigration front, you mean?
On immigration, yeah. On health care.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you may be right.
It's scary to people to think they're going to lose their health care. So I think it's not just this, because we have normalized. He's so outrageous that we're like the frog in the boiling water. We're sitting here getting boiled, and people don't seem to realize it because he's so – I mean, you get the emails, and people always compare this to Clinton meeting Loretta Lynch in the tarmac. Well, you know, they shouldn't have done that. But again, it's kind of small potatoes. There's a whataboutism.
I think the frog image is perfect, because if it turns out that we knew nothing about this, mm-hmm. nothing, there had been no reporting, and the Mueller report came out this morning, and we learned
it would be like an explosion.
An explosion. We have Melissa in the car. You've been very patient. I really appreciate calling. Thank you very much, and welcome to the show. Hi, Melissa.
Thank you, guys.
Sure.
I literally am at a who cares? Who cares? Like Marjorie just said, a list of things that everyday people care. No one even cares anymore what's in the report. Like, just Democrats, and I think Pete Buttigieg said it correctly. Like, Trump was able to get them to focus on him the entire election, that they had no plan. They didn't put out anything. I don't even know what Hillary Clinton was talking about, because all I remember was constant attacking Trump. And he's doing it again. Like, they're so focused on him that they're forgetting, like, hey, let's put out policies to impact people's lives. And Trump actually, and I do not like him, but he actually put out policies that were lies, but at least he was out there talking about it instead of talking about everyone else. It is so frustrating that I literally have stopped listening to news.
Melissa, don't go away, because you are exactly who I'm talking about. She is not a Trump fan, Marjorie, so she's not one of these people. Trump can do no wrong, but Melissa's message is move on. Fix what I need, what my family needs. I don't think she's atypical. What do you say to her?
Well, I'll say what I just said, that Melissa, the Democratic candidates are talking about those things. And I'll also say that on the day that this report comes out, it's hard to move on today or tomorrow, because I do disagree with you. I know that people that like the president will say, well, the United States interferes with elections all the time. We try to topple dictators. And we do. But I don't want the Russians affecting who wins the presidency. And I don't want them to affect who wins an office in my state of Massachusetts. I want to know that my vote is kind of sacrosanct. So it is a big deal to me. Is it as big a deal about whether you get health care that you can afford? That's for every person to decide. But I don't want Vladimir Putin deciding who the next president of the United States is going to be. I don't.
Do you have a thought on that, Melissa, or no?
Well, my thing is that the reality is the United States has been doing that to the rest of the world for decades.
That happens to be
and it
true.
Wasn't a problem when we were doing it, but because Russia did it to us, and I'm not for it for us to do it or for anyone to do it to the United States. But for the hypocrisy of everyone, Democrats and Republicans, to say, oh, well, we don't want this done to us, when America's been doing it to other countries and dictating who their presidents should be for decades, and really has, you know, affected regions around the country, around the world in a negative way. And
Melissa,
so the hypocrisy of this now is hilarious. And then also, Democrats didn't win because they tripped up Bernie Sanders. If they had played fair, we might not be in the situation we're in now. But because Hillary Clinton felt that she deserved to, she was born to be the president of the United States. Her campaign and the people in the DNC did some things that led us to where we are today.
Melissa, that was a very thoughtful call. Thank you
but
very much for your
time.
But just one
thing. I think history shows that a lot of people did care when we interfered in other countries' elections. I mean, I think that there was a lot of that hidden was going on. I think a lot of people did care about what went wrong when we tried to regime change in Iraq or when Barack Obama tried to do it in Libya.
In Iran?
Yeah. So I think people do care. But again, given a choice, I would rather not have – I mean, I think the United States is a little bit – exceptional. I don't want it to happen here.
Let's go to South Dartmouth. Matthew's on the phone. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
We really appreciate both.
Great to be on.
Thank you.
Yeah, I actually am more on the side of Melissa. I kind of figured that we've known who Trump is for a while. I'm not a fan of him, but I'm just kind of completely shocked and I've lost my party and the Democrats, and I'm more of an independent these days because I'm kind of just shocked at how out-lefting everyone's trying to be, especially with the candidates currently, and I just want everyone to move on from this Mueller report. I'm completely fatigued by this. It's kind of amazing how we're still trying to bring stuff up. Like, we've known who he is for a long time. He's not the best guy, but considering that we're still trying to find something and find a good reason to oust him is just unbelievable to me.
Matthew, don't go away. Yesterday, you used the term move on, and I read, this is before, obviously, today's release, when Juliette Kayyem was here, I read to Marjorie and Juliette a poll that was reported on CNN saying 54% of the people said move on, and we all disagreed on what it meant. What does move on mean to you? Should Congress, at minimum, is going to hold hearings on this? Mueller is going to be called to testify. Barr will testify. They'll probably at a number of committee levels. Should they not even be doing that? Or what does move on mean to you, I guess I'm asking?
Move on means to me more as just stop trying to make it such a big deal. Have these hearings, absolutely. That should always be pursued. But to kind of make everyone expecting that the next biggest thing is going to drop whenever the next report comes out that will oust the president that they've so outlandishly bad-mouthed or brought to light the things that we've already known and made such a big deal. I'd rather us kind of go, like Melissa just said, kind of go back to the issues that need to be addressed, because currently I just can't find my place with the issues that are going on right now.
Matthew, thanks for your first call. Make another one soon. We really appreciate it. 877-301-8970. I don't even know what I'm advocating.
Well, he's
for
talking
here.
About having hearings.
No, but having hearings, that's fine. But I don't know if Melissa would be against hearings.
Yeah.
But
so what are you talking about? Impeachment or no impeachment?
Well, I guess that I'm guessing that's what move on means. I don't know what it means to the vast majority of people, but I think they're far. I know it doesn't make you happy, but you, Marjorie. But I think they're far more Matthew and Melissa's who are not Trump idolizers, are not totally in the tank to Trump. In fact, it's pretty clear neither of them are crazy about him, but have had enough, frankly. And
but I guess, again, what does that mean? Matthew says he's had enough, but he wants to have hearings.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what that means.
Well, I mean,
I mean, the report came out this morning.
Yeah. I don't think anybody is saying,
to talk about it?
No, but I think that's being really unfair to these people. I don't think either of them are saying, by the way, can we talk about Medicare for all today?
Mm-hmm.
It came out 3 hours ago. Maybe it doesn't mean next week either. But I think what they're saying, I'm not, by the way, embracing either side in this. I'm just trying to assess where I think people are, and I don't think they're atypical. I think most people don't believe that members of Congress, arguably, and this is a new one, a relatively new one, for the last decade has been as dysfunctional as probably any, as dysfunctional as any Congress probably in our lifetimes, don't have the ability to do a couple of things well at the same time. And they may say, I'd prefer you to fix what I'm really scared about, which is apparently not the state of our democracy, and more bread and butter kinds of issues.
But again, you look at what the people that are running for president are talking about. I mean, Elizabeth Warren has talked about,
everything. She's hit every policy.
She has
hit
every single solitary policy. If you look at Buttigieg, he's a little, fuzzy on some of the policies. But a lot of these people that are – Bernie Sanders is talking about policies. They are talking about Medicare for all. Or do you want to have, Medicare for people that are 55? They're all talking about these policies. So it's as if, we can't, to use the cliche, walk and chew gum at the same time.
But you got to move. If you're going to do major reforms in this country, you got to enlist the support of the public.
Correct.
I think it is fair to say that if the Democrat, again, I'm not arguing against this. I don't even know what my position is. I'm just trying to reflect where I think people are, is if the Democrats decide that the focus, the primary focus, I'm talking about members in Congress who can actually make laws and change laws, is going to be on Donald Trump, then that is going to take all the oxygen out of the room. And on the nightly shows and the front pages of the New York Times, is going to be that.
Whose fault is that?
What do you mean?
When you take the oxygen out of the room, you could say it's the fault of a lot of the media, particularly the cable shows
that
are on television at night.
Is that we can't walk and chew gum at the same time.
Pick up your newspaper. Pick up the Boston Globe this morning. Pick up the New York Times. There's a million stories about all these other things. Cable news has kind of – when people talk about the media, I often wonder, what are you talking about? Are you talking about between 7 and 10 o'clock at night on MSNBC or CNN or Fox News? Or are you talking about, National Public Radio? Or are you talking about your local newspaper?
Well, I'll give you a good example. You and I both thought, I'd say a year ago, that the station that played it most down the middle was CNN. CNN is a 99%, I think on the merits the most of the time, but it is a Trump-obsessed cable news network. Is that not a fair statement?
And why do you think it's Trump-obsessed?
Because that's where the ratings are.
Because that's where the money is.
Well, exactly. But I'm saying, so if the fairest of the three cable stations is doing nothing but Donald Trump, explain to me how we're all of a sudden going to get to some major health reform just because Bernie and the other Democrats are talking about it.
We just had the 2018 elections, and what was the driving issue?
Healthcare was really
healthcare.
High up there. Yeah.
So I think Americans are, for the most part, pretty smart people. They know what their issues are. Paying for college, getting health care that they can afford, housing issues. Those are all going to be the issues, I think, and climate change is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. So I don't think the Russian investigation is going to be the primary issue of the election of 2020. But again, I don't think you can ignore this because these are, if you don't want to call them high crimes and misdemeanors, they're pretty close.
Why do you think – you're a big fan of Nancy Pelosi. We only have 30 seconds left. Why do you think she said impeachment's off the table if she doesn't see the American people as being exactly where I see them as being?
Because I think she's a very smart strategist, and she thinks that the best way – because the country's so divided that any kind of impeachment, which would fail anyway in the Republican Senate, would be looked at like a coup from the deep state, and that if you do not like Donald Trump, then the best thing to do is to get to the ballot in 2020 and vote for somebody else.
Fair enough.
Fair enough, Jim.
So we're done with our first installment of Mueller time.
Yeah, and we'll,
well, this
we'll
has
go
been
on,
exhausting.
We'll go on
it?
For the next,
Well, by the
we'll
way,
move on tomorrow,
I am not,
Jim.
To be clear, don't put me in the camp that says let's ignore this whole thing. This is a major moment in American history, and we should focus on it because it threatens our democracy.
Okay.
So
I think you're just giving me a hard time.
No, I'm not giving you a hard time.
Yes, you are. You're jealous because the cat had more Twitter followers than you. And that's
I didn't
upsetting.
Say it did. It might have. It might have had a few more.
All
problems.
Right, we're done. Thank you for listening to another edition
cat.
Of Boston.
We're
going to
do a whole show on Embassy Cat
it
tomorrow.
Is embarrassing to be out-tweeted.
Twitted, too. No, I am out-tweeted by everybody.
Okay.
I'm just out-tweeted
You
by
can
the
always
cat.
Find us by way of our podcast and iTunes. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to be at the Boston Public Library. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is going to be there, and she's going to be there early bird special.
We're pre-taping
9
at
9. O'clock.
Right. Very good
If you
point.
Want to see the Congresswoman, come on down to the library. It opens at 9. She'll be there.
And then we're going to play it during the show, but it's going to be pre-taped at 9.
Yes. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Mers, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker. Okay, Mr. Move On. What are you talking about on TV tonight?
I'm not saying move on. Congressman Joe Kennedy is going to join me with his reaction to all this. And then two former U.S. attorneys, one a Republican, one a Democrat, Don Stern and Michael Sullivan. Mm-hmm. They're going to break down all the legal stuff from today. It's an all Mueller kind of show, except...
Okay.
We're going to focus the end of the show on the great 16-year-old environmental activist we discussed with Bill McKibben yesterday, Greta Thunberg, who almost single-handedly may be changing the world.
Okay. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning.
Jim's not moving on tonight. He'll be moving on tomorrow.
I'm not moving on.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you very
See
much
you
for listening.
Thanks.
Please tune again tomorrow. Have a great afternoon. We'll be at the library. If you're in the neighborhood, stop by and say hello. Thanks.